Richard E. Grant. From the Metropolitan Planning Council, Alden Laurie, and Chicago chef, Harry Nahabedian. And now, here's your host, a man who thought pre-existing condition was something from college philosophy class, Justin Kaufman.
If we don't pre-exist, can you hear it in the woods? I forgot how to end it. Something like that. I think it was Plato who once said, what do we need to pre-exist in this world? And then he went, ow, my back! Then they wouldn't let him have Greek insurance. Oh, what a day, huh? Hey, it's a download here on 720 WGN with you till 11 o'clock tonight. I'm Justin Kaufman. What a fun night on Michigan Avenue. You can see it might be a little brisk, but right now people are out and about. A beautiful Thursday night in Chicago. As always, it's a pleasure to be here with you, to ride shotgun, to be a part of your life tonight, to sort of be the background noise, if you will, for you and whatever you're doing, whether you're at work, whether you're commuting tonight, maybe you're at home already. Maybe you're already putting dinner on the table. Maybe the family doesn't talk at all. They just listen to the show. I can do that. Timmy, finish that broccoli. See, I can do it. Maybe you're doing dishes right now. Maybe you're just settling in for the rest of the night. Whatever you're doing, I got your back. I'm here tonight. We got a great show lined up for you. Coming up at 8 o'clock tonight, Richard E. Grant in studio. The award-winning British actor is playing Dr. Henry Higgins, or Professor Henry Higgins, in My Fair Lady at the Lyric Opera right now. The famed musical and, of course, movie starring Audrey Hepburn. Sorry, I get my words right. I'm already tripping. You remember that great actress? Aubrey. It's fascinating. We were just talking about with Anna and Rich, like the idea of a play or a musical that is written in a different time, 1956. If you know anything about My Fair Lady, and you probably do if you're listening to, you know the story. It's a famous story, won Oscars, and it's been, you know, you probably know it if you have kids because they probably did a play version of it at some point, right? The Rain in Spain, that whole scene. The Rhine and Spine. He essentially takes Eliza Doolittle and he makes a bet to see if he can refine her, make her sort of an upstanding, you know, high class British lady. And she's sort of like a down and out lowly Cockney accented flower girl. And in doing so, it's just the dialogue. It's a script. He's rude. He's dismissive and he's cruel. And it kind of comes back to haunt him. That's part of the arc. But it's almost in our society in 2017, there's just no time for it. You know, you could see how it sort of evolves and it sort of neatly sort of lays itself out in this play. And you can understand how cruelness needs to be replaced by kindness if he really wants to get what he wants and or what he needs. But I watched it at the Lyric Opera with a bunch of high school kids because it was field trip day. And so I just kind of snuck in the back and watched the play or watched the musical. I keep saying the play, it's a musical. And so it had a whole different experience of watching this because there were a couple songs like, what it's like, why would anybody, I'm a bachelor, why would anybody want a woman? And then there was also, you know, why wouldn't a woman want to be a man? And they're all jokes, 1956 jokes. They're charming mm-hmm. and whimsical and that kind of thing. But man, these kids are just like, uh-huh.
Responding to the dialogue.
They're just like, or not. I mean, there were obviously some of that stuff is joke lines. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, nope, ain't having it.
Huh.
So it's interesting to talk to Richard about that, about the concept of a play like My Fair Lady that has can mean something entirely different 60 years later.
At least they had reactions or non-reactions. I remember I took a humanities class in high school, which I believe was it was a Catholic school, and the brother's excuse to go see free shows,
right,
and
sure.
He took the kids along. And I just remember snoozing during all of them.
It was a right to fall asleep at Les Mis.
Exactly.
It was a right. That was like, we've all been there. It was like you go to Les Mis, and then maybe you hit Ed DeBevick's. on the way out of town.
Well, you can criticize these kids, but you know, they're awake. Or woke, if you will.
Right. Woke and awake. Maybe a couple snoozes. Look, quick 20-minute snoozes in there. Also tonight, a tremendous chef, Carrie Nahabedian, will be here. She, of course, is the chef at Naha, one of the great fine dining restaurants, French restaurants here in Chicago. We'll talk to her about her award-winning career as well. To have her, Chef Nahabedian, in studio is a pretty great thing. I mean, she is in the Culinary Hall of Fame here in the city of Chicago. For her to come in to talk about her career and life and her restaurant, which is really is known around the world. It's funny. It's the old Gordon's space across from Rick Bayless's place on Clark Street here in the Gold Coast. So we'll talk with her coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight. Much, much more. We'll talk also, you know, we'll continue our conversation with the Metropolitan Planning Council. You know, I had Alden Laurie in here not too long ago. We talked about the cost of segregation. And they're continuing that investigation, the exploration of the census numbers in the last 20 years. And it's really interesting to see, you know, because they talked about, you know, because we live separately in the city, what are the actual costs on transportation, on economics, everything, jobs, everything. What they're doing this time around is really taking a close look at white flight. And it's something that we think about in the 50s and 60s, you know, that sort of happened in the south side of Chicago. But it's continuing to happen. And it happens regularly in the suburbs. South suburbs are a great example of there will be a white population, say, in Calumet City, that over 10 years' time, 60% leaves. And what happens is the jobs, the factories, the small businesses, the businesses, they follow suit. And it's a weird anomaly to think about that it would follow lines of race. But a lot of times, after there's a significant amount of white flight, the jobs go away too. And it's just interesting to think about all the things that go into segregation and some of the societal issues we have when it comes to our economy. So we'll talk with Alden about that coming up here in the 7 o'clock hour after the 7:30 news. News, weather, and traffic tonight with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon. Production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, you know what we'll do? We'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll do the carryout. Stay with us. We got a big show, so let's get to it. Let's do the carryout. All right, here are today's top stories. It's here. Everybody's talking about it. It's going to change the way we live our lives forever. Yep, Prince Philip retired. And I know, I'm taking a pause. What else today? Oh, this little nugget. The U.S. House passed a new health care bill today, repealing and replacing Obamacare. In a tight vote, Republicans passed a bill that most everybody, including most of the lawmakers that voted for it, didn't like. The reason? Because they said they would. Can't campaign on something and then give it up when you win, regardless if it's bad for the country. That's politics 101. Now the propaganda machine begins with many hypotheticals swirling around the left's echo chamber. Pre-existing conditions will be back. Funding stripped for mentally disabled students. All female reproductive health coverage will cease to exist. The truth is, we just don't know. The bill hasn't really been read by anybody, and the Congressional Budget Office hasn't told us anything about cost. So everything you hear today is a hypothetical and designed to scare you into some sort of political action. It's called a political blueprint. Death panels, anybody? Can't see your own doctor? I mean, it's all the same. This bill could be terrible, or it could push down premiums, or it could end the country as we know it. No doubt there will be chatter for weeks to come as the bill goes to the Senate and then back to the House, then to a committee, then back to the House, like a Benny Hill montage. One thing I will say about this, it's still federally subsidized health care. And you can call it whatever you want. You can be mad about it, but we're still a country that provides it. That's pretty interesting. And I think it's something we should applaud. And then just when I feel somewhat patriotic, I heard the president speak.
How am I doing? Am I doing okay? I'm president. Hey, I'm president. Can you believe it, right? Let's go out, just short little shots for each one of us, and let's say how good this plan is. We don't have to talk about this unbelievable victory. Wasn't it unbelievable? So we don't have to say it again. But it's going to be an unbelievable victory, actually, when we get it through the Senate.
Come on, man. I love that he says, we don't need to brag about how great it was. Wasn't it great? Then you hear that and you remember that the reason healthcare was reformed was not because of helping Americans to have better insurance options, but it's a huge tax cut and an ego boost for guys like President Trump. Hey, the rich don't have to pay for the sick anymore. Na 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 na, na 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 na, hey, hey, hey. Come on, man. In other news, let's move on, because that's another thing, too. I will have a long 2-hour show, and we'll do the whole thing when the Senate actually votes on this thing. Because my guess is Senate's going to go, next. In other news, the president signed an executive order for religious liberty today. This gives the IRS the power to look the other way when it comes to political speeches from the church pulpit. When reached for comment, Father Flager was like, oh, wait, you can't do that? But now we can. Oh, whew. I thought I was going to have to rewrite what I had ready for Sunday. But many religious leaders and conservatives are a bit perplexed at why there was even a need to do this in the first place. See, it would take an act of Congress to change the Johnson Amendment, so an executive order is pretty much useless, especially since the IRS already looks the other way. See Flager. And the Supreme Court had already told the Obama White House to work with the not-for-profits over contraceptives and religious objectives and healthcare plans, so that really doesn't need to be addressed. And really, after much speculation, Trump omitted the highly controversial idea of being able to discriminate against people based on your faith. So what's in this executive order? Because what it says, I think, is it just says, if you read the little thing that he says, it says, I'm for you, evangelicals. Really, I think it's just an executive order that he wanted to do on National Prayer Day. I'm surprised Trump didn't pray out loud, thanking God for his Electoral College victory. Instead, he said, freedom is a gift from God. Really? Didn't we fight for those freedoms? I don't remember it being a gift. I mean, I wasn't there, but I don't remember it being a gift. Also on Capitol Hill today, Susan Rice, former NSA director, is not testifying in front of a Senate committee. She was alleged to have unmasked certain members of the Trump transition team and intercepted communications. Was it for political gain? Well, her lawyers say she's not testifying because the Democrats on the committee says she doesn't have to, and all the invitations so far have been bipartisan. So why doesn't she have to? I'm confused. Seems like Democrats in the Senate want to, wake up from their after-lunch nap and rethink that position. Doesn't it always feel like Democratic senators are this close to napping when you watch the when you watch the hearings? I must be the cushy high back leather chairs. Now I want to ask you. All right, the Obamas gave the city of Chicago $2 million for summer jobs. Break that down, and that's 3 Wall Street speeches. That's great. In weather, a little bit more rain this morning, but hey, you know what? Will you take the cold over the rain? Sounds like a lyric from an 80s metal band. Will you take the cold over the rain? Something like that. In sports, the Cubs finish up their 4-game set with the Phillies in dramatic fashion. They won in the bottom of the 13th on a walk-off botched double play. You know how it's drawn up. The Cubs win because the Phillies lost. They end up taking 3 of 4 from the Phillies, just doing what they do, right? It just doesn't matter if they go down early. They're always in the game. Even errors go in the Cubs' favor. Baseball's very peaks and valleys, though, so let's hope there's no karma attached to this victory. The Sox split the 4-game series with the Royals. Another good outing today from Derek Holland, who gave up 2 runs and 3 hits over 6 2/3. He just continues to have a stellar season on the South Side and has been a big factor for the Sox. Great start. Keep it up. You may pitch yourself into trade consideration. Also, Matt Davidson, another big day subbing in for Todd Frazier, has got a stiff back. The Sox have played all, this is so interesting, the Sox have played all but 3 of their games against AL Central foes. So is that good? Does that mean they're doing well against the competition they need to do well against, but are they going to go out and play the A's and get killed? We'll see. The Bears announced jersey numbers today. Troops going to be number 10, Kevin White, 11, Marcus Wheaton, 12, Kendall Wright, 13. So what? It's just over. The idea of receivers wearing numbers in the 80s, that's just over. That's gone. It's the past. No more 88s or 83s or good old number 85. That's so passe. Now it's 11, 13. What are these guys, Bob Avellini fans? Come on, man. In NBA playoff news, the Spurs lose Tony Parker for the rest of the playoffs. Tough time to lose an old point guard. Yeah, we don't know anything about them. And finally tonight, today is May 4th, so it's May the 4th Be With You Day, otherwise known as Star Wars Day. It's a day that millions of fans can be nostalgic for the last Star Wars movie that came out 5 months ago. I hate to say it, but you really can't have a, isn't Star Wars the greatest, when Hollywood's like, isn't Star Wars greater than the last one we just did? That's the carryout for May 4th. In honor of Star Wars Days, we're offering up chewy chicken sandwiches. Sorry, the chicken's a little tough. All right, coming up, we'll talk about the cost of segregation. Continue the conversation, this time around job loss in Chicago suburbs. It's a download here on 720 WGN. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
Oh, man, so good, so good. Justin, I'm so excited today. You know, see, my health care premiums and deductible went up under what was called the ACA, or the Affordable Care Act. Now I can't wait to see how much they're going to go up under this. I'm excited. You know, it's going to be fun when I get that notice in the mail from Blue Cross Blue Shield saying I'm going to have to pay like 10% more each year.
Do you feel, now, I mean, it's tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, do you feel as someone who, I mean, do you feel like you might see less on the premiums?
Yes. No. We're all going to be paying more. See, that's the dirty little secret that both sides don't want to let you know about.
Right.
That regardless of who's in power or what legislation's jammed down everyone's throat,
right,
is that we're all going to be paying more.
It's such an interesting story. Let's talk about it later tonight.
Yeah, sure.
I did a bunch of reading on it, trying to understand what was actually in a bill that no one was allowed to read. and then, therefore, having, you know, Facebook and social media kind of yell at me all day, telling me what was in it. Like, I found that to be interesting. As someone who's been in the news business, I'm like, no one knows what's in it, but why does Facebook know?
Well, the reason why I'm so overly excited about it right now, and again, we will talk about it later, is that I did read some of it.
Mm.
And we have good health coverage here with Tribune Media.
Mm-hmm.
But part of this new legislation, if it makes it through the Senate, which it probably won't, but if it does,
we'll change
is that it will strip some of that away from us.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
Thanks, Rob. It's a download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 8 o'clock, Richard E. Grant's going to be in studio. He's playing Professor Henry Higgins at the Lyric, My Fair Lady. Richard E. Grant just was on the silver screen as the villain in Logan, the X-Men movie. Yeah. He's such a recognizable actor. He's in so many things. He's been like, I mean, you look at his IMDb, and it's just you have to scroll a couple times to get through Richard E. Grant's bio. So we'll talk with him about being on stage here in Chicago, but also about his career coming up at 8 o'clock. Well, a new Metropolitan Planning Council analysis shows that segregation is having a profound economic impact on our region. Last month, we talked about the cost associated with living separately. Tonight, we talk about how segregation, white flight, and poverty seem to be indicators for job loss. Essentially, jobs, and specifically job creators, tend to leave an area when white people do. Interesting insights in this analysis. Let's take Calumet City, for example. From 2000 to 2010, Calumet City saw its white population drop by more than 60%. And if you look at job loss since 2010, they've lost 30%, while the rest of the region increased by 12%. This is a telling stat. In most of the regions analyzed in Illinois, there are 420 jobs for every 1,000 residents. In Calumet City, 160 jobs for every 1,000 residents. It's worth a conversation on the impact of who lives where and what job opportunities are available. In studio with me tonight, Alden Laurie. He's the Director of Research and Evaluation with the Metropolitan Planning Council. Alden, good to see you.
Same here, Justin. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us in studio, Rob Perrell. He's a demographer and consultant with Rob Perrell and Associates. Rob, thanks for being here as
Thank you so much.
So, I mean, talk about this, because this is really a continuing the what we talked about last month, is sort of the hidden costs of segregation. What took you down this path to talk about job loss?
I was curious about, as the region is kind of shifting, as Chicago's, that's part of our story, right? Not just the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when we saw the south and west sides of the city essentially essentially turned from white to black. We still see shifting demographic patterns out in the suburbs. And the Southland is one area that has become increasingly African-American over the last 30 or 40 years or so. So I was curious to see if there are other kinds of changes that are happening there. And so jobs is one way. And I saw jobs as an indicator kind of the economic vitality of an area. Hmm. You know, if there are jobs there, it's generally thought to be a strong area. If jobs are growing, it's getting stronger. If jobs are falling, then it's getting weaker. And so in looking at those numbers, I started seeing, you know, a pattern in terms of where jobs were declining or weren't growing very fast. And largely communities that are known to be majority black, majority Latino, particularly in the South and to some degree in the Western suburbs. And then when I overlaid that with population loss from 2000 to 2010, particularly for whites, then I started seeing a very interesting kind of connection.
And you're talking about, when we say job creation, we're talking about it could be anything but factories to retail to small businesses, things like that.
Yeah. And I didn't look explicitly at who the job creators were, but just, you know, the job totals themselves. I did look a little bit at this particular industry, so I have an idea of what the picture is like in some of these places. It's an interesting trend. And I haven't yet found what might be a very kind of clear explanation as to why we're seeing that. But generally speaking, when we see white population fall, there is an economic impact that happens as a result of that.
Rob, let's bring you in. Go ahead.
So, Justin, my take on Alden's very good research is that a lot of the jobs that go are retail jobs. And I'll tell you what the story is that, in the United States and in Chicago, the biggest predictor of your income level is your race. And so whites have a disproportionate amount of access to resources and income, okay? So when you have white flight and you have whites depart an area, mm-hmm. you lose a base of customers for retail jobs, okay?
You lose and expendable income, too.
You lose income. You're losing people with money in their pocket to go out to eat dinner every night, if that's what they do. You know, fill out their car completely instead of filling their gasoline tank half the way, et cetera. And so goes back to the problem of segregation. When you segregate like this, when you pull out a group that unfairly already has too much access to resources, you are left behind with populations that don't have a lot of resources and can't sustain an economic base.
Robert, I was reading the article that you were in with Greg Hines and Cranes just about, the median income of Chicago, according to the census, is pretty stagnant, in a good way, meaning it hasn't really changed. And you go, the economy may be recovering. We're better than other places. But when you drill down into communities, into different neighborhoods, into, as we've talked about, the sort of hidden costs of segregation, you'll see one area of the region doing well and other areas doing not as well.
This is the story of Chicago. We're sitting here in the Loop right now, and just a few blocks south of us is the South Loop that has booming population, high incomes. You go a few blocks south of that to the Douglas community area. You get south of 26th Street or so, and you're in an area where 40% of the population is below poverty. Right, so right next to each other, wealth and degradation, mm-hmm. Poverty, lack of income. That is the story of Chicago, and you can just cross the street and see the difference.
It's amazing, and I mean, it's interesting to know that we've had this story, we've told this story about Chicago, and we're very familiar with the idea of you can go a couple blocks and see inequality, but when you're talking about the suburbs, and you're talking about regions, especially Southland, it starts to get to, it seems the one thing we keep coming back to is race.
Yeah, it is. And, the interesting thing, too, is that if you drill down a little closer, let me start here. There's a ripple effect in terms of that loss of income, that loss of white population. And Calumet City is, I think, a really clear example of this with the River Oaks Shopping Center. That shopping center itself has also kind of gone through a transition. What was a very mostly white consumer base shopping there in the 70s and 80s and kind of became racially mixed in the 90s is now almost solidly an African-American shopping base. And it's not just that white people in the area, the immediate area, are leaving, but white shoppers who might be in the surrounding areas, as that mall's character, racial character has changed, those shoppers are no longer going there as well. So mm-hmm. when you have the white population loss, there's also this ripple effect in terms of the level of comfort or familiarity with the mall itself for whites who are in the surrounding areas. And so that's an added kind of the market is even smaller now for that mall. And that mall has suffered. The Lincoln Mall had went through that maybe a little earlier, and it's closed now because it had become, again, dependent upon a almost solely black consumer base. And it just wasn't enough income there to support it. Now, that's not to say that there isn't black income out there. And that's the other thing I think people have to kind of keep in mind. When you look at some of these South suburbs, Country Club Hills, Calumet City, when those became kind of booming destinations for the black middle class in the 80s and 90s,
right.
those places were still solidly okay economically. But that picture has changed to some degree now that the white middle class population that was in those suburbs is now gone. And so the suburbs can't really support themselves to the degree that they could, but that's not because they are necessarily impoverished areas. But if we characterize them that way and people avoid those areas to shop, avoid those areas to live, we're kind of writing the future of those communities
and sort of following the history of this town, especially when it comes to segregation, do the same thing over and over and over. You know, Rob, I want to ask just the concept. I mean, as you think about this city transforming itself, like any big city, we see, you know, different neighborhoods turn into different population, yeah. different ethnicities. You know, the gentrification plays a role. Why do we continue to come back to this idea that even though that happens, we still are one of the most segregated cities in the world?
You know, I'm glad we're talking about the suburbs, too, because when we talk about the Cook County suburbs, go back a few decades, they were much more homogenous. They didn't have the issues we're talking about of segregation and economic lows and highs. Whereas that was all a city story, but actually poverty in the suburbs and disparities between rich and poor and white and black is now a story of the suburbs. And there's a funny thing. Chicago is kind of like a shirt being turned inside out, and I'll tell you what I mean by that. Despite the fact that, you know, we sure have poverty here, there are some ways in which the city looks better than the suburbs for some populations. I did some research recently that showed that whites in Chicago, for the first time in history, are wealthier than whites in the suburbs or downstate Illinois.
Hmm.
So the locus of our concern about poverty, about the effects of segregation, they've moved to the suburbs. That's where a lot of it's happening.
Our sentiments, are we catching up with that emotionally? I mean, when we think about that, because, you know, everything that we, as human beings, we stereotype and we stigmatize, but we always think, you know, someone living in Hinsdale is going to have more money than someone living in Lakeview. I mean, are we catching up to changing that story?
My goodness, the DuPage suburbs used to be the bedroom suburbs par excellence, but they are suburbs of, a lot of them of poverty and of low income now. It's a very different landscape than we had years ago. Suburbs, it's more of a challenge in some ways because in Chicago, in a city, you've got a large infrastructure to potentially bring resources to a problem. When you're broken apart into 50 different suburbs in an area, every single area on its own fights this.
You know, the Metropolitan Planning Council, Mary Sue was in here, we talked about the idea of there being too many units of government, and that's been something that we've seen state politicians take on and want to change because it's just – and this is one of the problems where you can't throw money at certain problems when there's so many – you're the unit of government, then you know, there's no shared resources. And we talk about the big issues, and the governor has talked about this too, property taxes in the Southland area and the South suburbs. I mean, they're crippling. In the way that they're basing it on this idea that this once was a prominent, you know, had resources, you know, the middle class area, and it just doesn't reflect that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, when things are good, you know, the fact that we've got, you know, 300 municipalities in the region is not so much of an issue. But when things are tough, that becomes a real problem. And so you have some communities, particularly in the Southland, where you really have to ask the question now. Are these places viable enough to kind of pull themselves out of the hole they're in? And the property taxes is their number one enemy in trying to answer that question, because as those rates are very high, as the appreciation of the property there has really slowed, and in some places it's tracking the wrong direction. The extension is still the same, but the rates are higher, and that's a big you know, kind of black eye in terms of attracting residential, commercial investment, industrial investment. You know, places are like, well, I'm going to go, you're right across the border from Indiana. Mm-hmm. You've got the city of Chicago that has much more viable places to build a much lower property tax rate. And those places start kind of competing with one another, and it just becomes a very ugly situation. And I think, you know, the question for a lot of those places, and it's been posed recently in a Chicago Mag story where I was quoted in about annexation. Should some of those places open themselves up to being annexed by the city, or, you know, combining one another? And I think that is a question that those communities should start thinking and talking about more.
And this is something that we've known in the area. I think of Gary, Indiana, as an example of a town that as a majority black population, that wants to be a town that can be a middle class hub and bring businesses in. Is there hope for majority black Southland suburbs to take on that person to say, hey, this is we are a middle class suburb and we're going to try to attract jobs and job creators here. Not unlike what we see in some of the suburbs with the grocery stores or not suburbs in the South Side communities with grocery stores. Is there a glimmer of hope that they could sort of attract businesses, or I mean, is it just trending in the wrong way?
I would say there's a glimmer of hope. South Holland is one place where I'd point out among the majority black communities that were in the analysis that I did, 7 out of 8 of them were either losing population or losing jobs or losing both. 6 out of the 8 were losing jobs. South Holland was the only that was gaining population and gaining jobs. And so South Holland is doing something that is still working for it. It is still a solidly black middle class town. But you know, they've got to hold on to who they've got, and they've got to continue doing the work, the real hands-on work that appears to be happening on the ground there to kind of keep investment and draw investment in there. If you go across the border, there's an interesting thing happening. There's a fairly large number of black middle-class families from Chicago, from Cook County, that are crossing the border, and they're going to places like Merrillville. They're going to places, other places over there in Indiana. Now, Indiana's tax picture is different than what you find on the Illinois side, but I think those are places, maybe they aren't majority black places now, but there are places in the Southland or the Southwestern suburbs that could draw black middle class families.
Rob, as a demographer, and I'll end with you, just this concept of white flight, and we've seen it, you know, it's so historic here in the city of Chicago, city proper. To see it sort of playing out in suburbs, do you ever see a time when that will stop, or that the demographics of that will change?
Yeah, you know, the demographics of that are going to change eventually. You know, whites have been leaving Illinois for since 1950, by the way. So there's been white flight for a long time. It used to be from the city, now it's from the suburbs. But the other thing going on with whites that's actually really dramatic, even though it's a kind of thing that's hard to put your finger on, which is the aging. White households have fewer people in them. They're more often headed by a single older adult or two older adults. So the demography of whites in the Chicago area is really changing. I tell you, go out to, again, the DuPage suburbs, Downers Grove. You look at the median age of the white people in Downers Grove. It's way up there. Hmm. They raised kids 10, 20 years ago. Those kids are elsewhere. And then on the other hand, the other extreme, there's, you know, the story of kind of the north side of Chicago. You got a lot of young white professionals that have moved here from out of state to get some of the jobs that are downtown. So the white population itself has got kind of a pretty wacky demographic and set of trajectories going on.
Fascinating conversation. Rob Perrell is a demographer and consultant with Rob Perrell and Associates. Alden Lorry is a director of research and evaluation with the Metropolitan Planning Council. We continue our series of talking about the hidden costs of segregation on our city and the area in which we live. Love to have you guys back. Continue the conversation. Thanks for being my guest tonight. Coming up, Richard E. Grant in studio at the big table. Excited to talk to the man who plays Professor Henry Higgins on stage, My Fair Lady at the Lyric Opera. That was a good combo with Alden and Rob. We continue. I mean, it is. I mean, we were just saying on the way out, Alden said, you know, if you draw a line around a community and say, this is a black community, you start to see the things that you expect in the world, whether it be your investment in your house, jobs, everything else, be significantly lower. I mean, just by perception, not because of anything else. Yeah, I don't get it. We'll continue to talk about it. Maybe through our series, we'll figure out why it happens. Then we'll solve the world. We'll cure the world. All right, so Richard E. Grant coming up at the big table tonight. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Coffin. Well, my next guest is an award-winning actor who's playing Professor Henry Higgins on stage in the production of My Fair Lady at the Lyric, running through May 21st. Richard E. Grant isn't a stranger to the stage. He's actually reprising his role of Henry Higgins from a 2008 production. The musical made its Broadway debut in 1956, and a few years later was made into the classic film starring Audrey Hepburn in the role of Eliza Doolittle. It's a story of a high society British professor who takes a lowly Cockney accented flower girl and through a bet teaches her up and passes her as a refined high class British lady. It's a show that's about perception, transformations, and morality. Richard E. Grant has made his name on the silver screen with movies like Whitnail and I, L.A. Story, Bram Stoker's Dracula, that's just to name a few. And most recently, he played the villain Dr. Xander Rice in the X-Men movie Logan. But tonight, It's all about Henry Higgins and a little Eliza Doolittle. In studio, Richard E. Grant, my guest at the Big Table. Richard, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you very much.
I've been
a
fan of yours for a long time.
Thank you very much.
So let's talk about, I mean, this is, like I said, it's a reprisal for you. This is the second time through. What attracted you to doing My Fair Lady again?
I had done it at the Sydney Opera 10 years ago with a completely different cast and different production. So the opportunity, when it came up and they said, I got the offer from the Lyric Chicago to do it again, I thought, well, it's such an amazing story and such a great role. Why not have another stab at it? And I went to see Glenn Close in Sunset Boulevard on Broadway 2 months ago, and I was doing a movie with Melissa McCarthy in New York, and I asked her what it was like to revisit a role because she had done Sunset Boulevard 20 years ago. Wow. And she said, your experience, your life experience, and the advantage of having done it before means that you have a much richer experience the second time around.
Yeah,
and there's less fear.
Yeah, and I was going to say, as a movie actor, primarily, I mean, movies and television, yeah, you know, you don't necessarily come back to a role unless it's a sequel, a different script.
Exactly.
So there is something very unique as an actor to go back into the same role.
Yeah, and what's made this such a hugely enjoyable experience for me is playing opposite Lisa O'Hara. I think it's absolutely wonderful.
She's
as
great,
Eliza,
yeah,
Doolittle. She just has the acting chops. She sings, she dances like a dream. So, you know, it's very easy to, against Higgins's will, to fall in love with her on a daily basis playing this part. So all hands to Lisa.
I read this, and I don't know if it's true or not, but that in 2008, My Fair Lady was your first musical production.
It was, yeah.
So that's amazing to me for what's a distinguished career that you've done both on stage and screen. The idea that this is your first musical, was it just that you're not a singer or you're not a dancer? What was it that first kept you out, and what was it about My Fair Lady that got you in?
Well, the thing is that I think that actors, unless you identify yourself as somebody who can sing and dance, people don't naturally think of you, oh, well, that person can do that. So when I was asked to do this in Sydney, I thought, oh, well, you know, I have a go. And the fact that it was written for Rex Harrison, the man who created, mm-hmm, this role in the original musical in 1956. He had, I think, an 8-note singing range, and so they geared it entirely to him. And because he's a phonetics teacher, they came up with this Springgesicht, or whatever it's called, where you sort of speak sing the things until, right, you get to I've Grown Accustomed to Her Face, which is the end of the story, in which then logically he does begin to sing because his true emotions come out.
Yeah.
So legitimately it's not really a Broadway singing role in the traditional sense.
Right.
You know, it's not Tevye in Fiddler on the Roof.
But, you know, there's something about it. I mean, it's, you know, to see the show, especially here in Chicago with the Lyric, to see The Rain in Spain, you know, and, mm-hmm, to all these songs that we know and may not remember that they're from My Fair Lady, and then the song comes on. Mm-hmm. You know, there is this way that you say, ah, yeah, this is a different kind of musical, and the way there is a lot of talk. It's a sing-songy, it's different than the orchestra's going to pick up now, and we're going to do this 4-minute song, and we'll come back to the story.
Exactly. I think that essentially because it was based on George Bernard Shaw's Pygmalion play, and then Alan J. Lerner and Frederick Lowe wrote extraordinary music and very, very witty and perceptive lyrics to go with that. They have extended or made good on what is actually going on in the play. So it's not anything like a contemporary musical where I went to see Hamilton on my night off and there's almost not a single spoken line. Everything is rapped or, mm-hmm, it's continuous music.
Right.
So it's the opposite of that, you know, and a different experience.
This character, what is it? I mean, because, you know, Professor Higgins is a famous character, as you mentioned, Rex Harrison, this mm-hmm, concept that many people know, not only from the stage, but from the movie.
Uh-huh.
You know, what do you have to do when playing a character that's so iconic, that people know? They know that relationship. They know Henry Higgins. They know Eliza Doolittle. As an actor, what do you have to do? Do you have to differentiate it or to honor it?
Oh, that's a great question. The first thing I thought was, if they've offered it to me, I think the worst route or route that you can take is to go down trying to do a poor man's version imitation of Rex Harrison, because you can't succeed, because there was only one Rex Harrison and he was a great misogynist, I think, in real life. He's married many times and was appalling to women and appalling to all the Elizas that he worked with on the last tour he did in the States when he was 70 years old. And I know this, you know, it's all on record, so I'm not speaking out of turn. So instinctively, obviously, I went back to what Alan J. Lerner and George Bernard Shaw had described this character, and they said, you know, he's a very impulsive, he's like a boy man who is almost stuck in adolescence, that he approaches everything scientifically but has no real connection or understanding of other people's feelings. Mm-hmm. So he's almost like a teenager in a man's body. And when all the science and the phonetics training is put to one side and he has to deal emotionally with Eliza, who has transformed under his tutelage, then he's completely at a loss and tongue-tied about what to do. So that makes it a much more interesting journey to follow that. Otherwise, I think you end up inevitably with an upper-class English bully who is basically a misogynist, and you think, well, why would Eliza put up with him for more than 2 nanoseconds? And I think that this way round, you have a way into who this person is and why he's like he is, and why his mother treats him almost like a little boy. Of course, you know, he's a middle-aged, or in my case, older man. So, you know, that's what I went for.
Yeah, it's.
But of course, you can annoy people for that.
Well, and, you know. I mean, and I want to take a break so we can stay on time tonight, because there's a lot of great themes in here. And I kind of mentioned the idea of transformations and morality, but there's this sort of yin and yang when it comes to cruelness and kindness in this play or in this mm-hmm. musical, and the way that you play Henry Higgins and how it all folds out. Let's talk more about that. Richard E. Grant is my guest. He, of course, the award-winning actor. Latest we saw him as Dr. Xander Wright in the X-Men movie Logan. He's starring as Professor Henry Higgins on stage at the Lyric in My Fair Lady, running through May 21st. We'll take a break. We'll come back more with Richard E. Grant here at the Big Table. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest tonight at the Big Table, Richard E. Grant, the great actor. I got to say, as a kid.
The great Justin Kaufman.
The L.A. Story was one of my favorite movies of all time.
Oh, thank you very much.
You were so good in it.
Thank you.
What's that clanging? Oh, my dang testicles. That's the line. Anyway.
Steve Martin's dialogue.
Steve Martin.
He takes the credit.
He's in town playing Professor Henry Higgins in the production My Fair Lady at the Lyric, running through May 21st. You know, it's an interesting role. We were just talking before the break about Henry Higgins, because, yeah, I mean, you could just on paper, you could say, OK, he's just a misogynist who really wants to teach this lowly woman how to speak right, how to act right, manners and everything to pass her off as high society and win a bet. And in that, you know, there's a lot of these threads that are really on the borderline. Even now, I mean, this is a 1956 play, but looking to 2017, they come across as cruel. I mean, there's a cruelty to it. How do you see that balance between cruel and kindness? Because I know that it plays out, and that's part of the evolution of this musical.
I think that what is ameliorating about Higgins, from my point of view of playing him, is that he, as he states quite a few times in the play, he treats everybody the same, whether they're a duchess or a chambermaid or a flower-selling woman who's living on the curbstone. So his argument is that as long as you are true to yourself and you treat everybody the same, then you can't really be accused of being an upper-class bully or classist or sexist or any of those things. You know, I don't think you can really buy that. It's his way of saying, I'm giving myself license to do this. And he's tripped up by that by the end. But I think that what he absolutely believes in is that you can take somebody and by changing the way that they speak and therefore in upping their social standing, you open up a possibility for them to have a different kind of career and a better quality of life than if they stay speaking in the blue collar accent that she has. So it's a very idealistic notion that Higgins has.
It's a tremendous work, you know, the musical and the thread, because you'll watch and there'll be a couple songs in there that are about, oh, women, you know, and then at the end, you know, as you're watching watching the musical, you're like, wow, this is really cruel in 2017 for something that was written in 1956. Mm-hmm. But it understands its cruelty, and the twist in the story is, you know, that Henry Higgins has to understand that kindness goes a long way, and if he would do that, he might actually get what he wants.
Exactly.
But it's interesting, because with those songs, I mean, there's a song towards the end like, why can't women be like a man? There's a whimsical nature to it. There's a charming nature to it, and you can tell when it was written. The audience that I saw with was bunch of high school kids, and the high school kids, when there's the big scene at the end where, you know, Henry Higgins and Eliza Doolittle have it out, and Eliza says, I'm out, they see Henry Higgins as a villain.
Yeah,
they clapped, they almost stood up, they got so excited, they're like, yeah,
they applauded.
Do you notice a difference in the way that the text and the play or the musical plays in 2017 than it may have played in 1956.
Yeah, definitely. And your brilliant description of what happened this afternoon is something that we've only been doing it since Friday night, so a few performances, with a much more mature audience. But to hear that response from people who are under the age of 20 saying they're not putting up with the misogyny, that she as an emancipated woman needs to kick him up the butt.
Right.
That was absolutely visceral, and you could feel it throughout. And so that was, I was thrilled by that. I thought that was absolutely fantastic.
There's a lot. I mean, there's something great about, and there's a couple pieces of dialogue in this musical about morality, mm-hmm. and the idea of through a bet to your character and Pickering both deciding, you know, let's take someone up from the street level and let's see if we can transform them. This will be fun. The morality of the whole concept, and there's this, it seems to be a through line throughout the play. Do you notice that? Do you notice that a secondary thought about what My Fair Lady is really about?
Absolutely, because it was George Bernard Shaw's complete socialist conviction that every man and every woman should have equal opportunities. And by having his main character be the speech teacher, even when Alfred P. Doolittle, her father, who's a dustman, Eliza's father, comes in, within 5 minutes of hearing his take on not being able to afford living a moral life and being legally married mm-hmm. to Eliza's mother, Higgins immediately says, if we took this man in hand for 3 months, he could choose between a seat in the government or he could be, you know, a minister in the church. So he's always scientifically seeing that there is some way that by transforming somebody's speech, you increase their social prospects.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It's almost like the American dream.
It is. And I guess what I'm getting at is that the idea that this musical is over 60 years old. And the threads that it goes after, the inequality, the idea of morality about how we all should be given the same opportunities, mm-hmm. just the way we treat each other, misogyny and sex, they ring true today. I mean, there's yeah. not much different from 60, whatever that is, 61 years ago.
I think that's true. But what isn't so palatable about Henry Higgins is that he believes that everybody has to speak the way he speaks, and that will increase your chances. So almost the reverse has happened in England now, where almost everybody doing what you do, Justin, who works in broadcasting or in the media, if you speak like I do, that will be an impediment to your
really?
Getting ahead. Whereas if you have a regional accent or a much stronger ethnic accent...
So it's flipped.
It's flipped.
Yeah.
Yep.
It's interesting, too, because just in the... going through your life story, I mean, you came from...
I grew up in Swaziland.
Yeah, Swaziland.
In Southeast Africa.
But the idea of... when you did come to England, you had a different type of accent than that was normal. And you had to assimilate or have to deal with a lot of some of the threads that are in this musical.
Exactly, yeah. So transforming how you are or how you speak or how you present yourself is, in essence, what the play is about. And so the journey that Eliza goes on from being selling literally flowers in the most low-down job outside an opera house when it's freezing cold to rich opera goers, and then being mistaken for a Hungarian princess at a ball 6 months later is about as big a journey as you could go in a short space of time. Then, of course, you know, she rightfully says, what have you left me fit for? And Higgins hasn't really taken that on board, because he almost had like a teenage fantasy. You know, you take one person, you transform them into something else, and then it's like, well, you know, carry on and do it yourself. He hasn't thought through that section.
As an actor, as someone who, you know, you look at your credits and you do so many different television programs and films and stage work, do you get to a point where you want to find work that resonates with you personally, that there are some tenets in the work that have to do with your personal story or things that you've gone through? Or is it still like, hey, man, if I can get that Wendy's commercial, I'll take it?
It's probably, yeah, a bit of the Wendy's commercial, and if there's a song to go with it, yeah, I'll grab it. You know, the very nature of actors' careers, I think, I can remember Judi Dench, I played her son in a movie 100 years ago, and I said, what is the most powerful thing that you have as an actor? She said the word no. That if you're offered the exact same kind of role each time, that is the only power you really have, is to say, I won't do that. I won't keep repeating myself. So, you know, hopefully you know, it's a bit like blotting paper. You hope that somebody else is going to go, well, we're going to have you play somebody who's a bit like Justin Kaufman today. Okay. Okay. Yeah, I'll do that. Right, I'll see. Okay. I'll grow a beard.
Yeah, sure.
I'll keep smiling. And I'll be rude to the ushers in the theater.
You nailed it.
Yeah.
That's my life in a nutshell. Richard E. Grant is my guest. The award-winning actor is on stage as Professor Henry Higgins. My Fair Lady at the Lyric, running through May 21st. Let's take a break. We'll get an update on tonight's news. We'll come back. We'll continue our conversation. Richard E. Grant at the big table tonight. Stay with us. Welcome back to Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. My guest in studio, Richard E. Grant. He's playing Professor Henry Higgins on stage at the Lyric Opera, My Fair Lady, through May 21st. It's great to have you in Chicago.
How often do you
get through Chicago? I mean, is this a place that you've performed in before?
I'd never been to Chicago, Justin. Yeah, I'd worked in various other cities and filmed on location in parts of the country, but I'd never been to Chicago before. So having grown up on Some Like It Hot and the Al Capone legend and all of that, I sort of had an idea that Chicago is a black and white city with gangsters. So I now know that it's not. And apparently, you know, according to Frank Sinatra on State Street, that great street.
Right, right.
I just want to say they do things they don't do on Broadway and all that stuff.
Right, you got it.
So, yeah.
He came here, he saw State Street's under construction. You're like, no, this is not what I thought. You know, one of the things we were talking about with My Fair Lady, and it's so interesting the way that new audiences, younger generations, take the show, is this idea of, I know Professor Henry Higgins, and I think, yeah, I guess he's a great hero, anti-hero, villain, charmer, everything wrapped into one. Like he's the great star power of Broadway. Like, this is a great role where there's a lot of complexities to him. But there is this idea with the new generation that he's a villain. There's a villain aspect. Do you see that? I mean, do you delight in the idea? Because you've played villains in your career. I mean, just in Logan, you were the big villain.
Yeah.
Do you bring that out in Henry Higgins?
Well, I think that, you know, there is such a tradition now in the last, I don't know, probably 80 years of having a British actor playing a villain in things, because somehow in the politically correct era that we're in, if you have somebody of another ethnicity,
right,
people take umbrage,
right,
and, you know, people get up in arms. But somehow if you go for the people that, you know, colonized you a few centuries ago, if you slag the Brits off, especially the upper classes, it's just
Do you find yourself being typecasted at all? I mean, did they go, oh, you know, it'd be great for this? Richard E. Grant. Let's get Richard in here
to
play villains.
Yes, probably. Yes, exactly. Yeah. But this afternoon's performance that you saw with all the school students,
yeah,
that was definitely a level of villainy that we had heretofore not quite experienced in quite the same way with a more mature audience. So I don't know whether that makes you an infantile young man, Justin, or just an old guy crocking about amongst the youngsters. I don't know.
I booed. No, but I do think that there's something. I mean, you hit on it, and I read about that too. I think you said that in Vogue as well, the idea that for whatever reason political correctness has passed up British actors, you could play the villains. And do you find yourself being offered parts like that? Do you find yourself, you know, in a sense, people always coming back saying, oh, you play a great villain? Because you were a great villain in Logan. I mean,
thank you. Well, I think what it comes down to is the very nature of the way that English or upper-class English or received pronunciation English, which I'm supposed to be an example of, means that you can sound very easily entitled and self-important and self-assured in a way that you may not in real life be, but you give that impression. So that, I suppose, that British tradition that came out of the British Empire over 200 years of maintaining a stiff upper lip and ruling the world, that hangover of that still has some kind of, I don't know, shadow in the way that people perceive you. I think that gives, you know, it's a good license to be villainous with those credentials.
I mean, are there roles at this point in your career that you want to seek out? I mean, because I read about Game of Thrones and the way that you were excited about they wanted an actor, and you're like, I'll do that. I always want to be a part of that. Or, you know, even being a part of a Marvel Comics franchise like X-Men. I mean, are there things as in your own life, personal stuff, that you want to seek out to be a part of as an actor?
Yes. I want to play somebody in the Tribune Building with headphones and a beard because I'm unable to grow one, who is quick-witted and sassy and speaks with a Chicago accent. That is what I would like to do next.
The Tribune building got sold, so it'll
be
different. Yeah, so, I mean, it had to be a period piece at a certain point, right?
Okay, all right. Well, I'm not averse to doing period pieces. I've been in wing collars for many years.
For you as, I mean, and we've talked about this, I mean, you being a film actor and a television actor, I almost consider that to be first and then stage second, mm-hmm. just based on how your career has played out.
Yeah.
Do you approach the craft in a different way? I mean, for you to get on stage in front of the beautiful Lyric Opera, but there's thousands of
3,600
people a night to watch you do Henry Higgins. I mean, do you approach that in a different way than what you do, like, you know, doing a scene with Hugh Jackman and Logan?
I mean, you're just aware of the scale is the only thing that is different. But essentially, I think that it comes down to, do you either believe what you're saying or singing or you don't? And that, I think, transmits to an audience. In the same way that I don't know whether you can actually teach people to act. You either believe the person in front of you is you believe what they're saying mm-hmm. or you don't. And how that happens, I have no real understanding of that. And every time I hear actors try and explain it, or people try and explain it, it goes into gobbledygook talk to me. It's like artists talking about, you know, the meaning when the obvious joke about abstract expressionist paintings. As they talk about it, I think, I don't want to hear that.
I don't want to get my own impression. You
have a feeling from it, and it's something that you can't, you can intellectualize it, but it sounds instantly pretentious to me. So every time I see anybody where actors are trying to explain how they act or why they act, I literally run for the trees.
But I mean, in your case, I feel like you started your career in film, mm-hmm. and that is a different style. I mean, you're talking about, you know, directors yelling cut and trying to get into a moment and play small but also big to what essentially is going to be on a silver screen or, you know, in somebody's living room at a later time. There is something about the stage work that is ultimately different. I mean, it's about an experience in the moment at that time.
Yes.
So do you, as an actor, prefer one or the other? Is there something where you love that those kids all screamed and yelled when Eliza walked out that gives you sort of a feeling?
Adrenaline rush? Because you don't. When you're doing any kind of filming for TV or a movie, you have no response because the crew has to be quiet, because if they're not quiet, you have to redo a scene because there's technical problems. Or an airplane goes over or whatever. Whereas in the theater, you do have this luxury of going from the beginning of the play to the end. So you do go through the whole life of how that character is written. And that feeling and the response you get from an audience, and it does change from audience to audience, especially as you witnessed this afternoon, where you had this completely different response from a much older audience, mm-hmm. which is generally what a theater audience is because it's so costly to go for the most part. So that makes it different. Whereas in a movie, by the time you get to see it, a year has gone by and you're sort of trying to remember who you even worked with and how it's cut or whether you've been cut out of it or added or whether they've dubbed you or whatever. So you have no control over that. Whereas in the theater, you are, you know, for better or worse, you are going through the whole experience right there and then with a live audience. And that is exhilarating when it works.
When it works. When, you know,
and when it's bad, it is gruesome. As you know, there is nothing worse than bad theater. It's the most painful thing. Whereas you can sit through any old schlock of a movie, I think. But if it's bad or really mediocre theater, I think that's a tough call.
You know, for you and your career, when you have so many titles to your name, and it's fun to look down and be able to, like I said, see such great films, you know, L.A. Story and others in there that you've done over time. You've done a mix of comedy. You've done a mix of drama. Mm-hmm. You really have diversified your portfolio when it comes to being an actor. Does that help you at the end of the day? I mean, if you would have stayed, I'm just going to do comedy. I'm just going to continue to do comedy and you find yourself doing more movies with Melissa McCarthy. Or, you know, I'm just going to do drama and I'm going to be on a fast track for Oscars. Does it help or does it hurt to have so much diversity in your
That suggests, Justin, that there is a great deal of control about what you do. It's literally, it's a crapshoot. It's much more arbitrary than that. It's literally somebody comes up and says, somebody's either dropped dead or they didn't want to do this or they're pulled out. Are you available or you were the first choice and they went to somebody else? You have no real control over that other than to say, you know, what I mentioned earlier about Judi Dench's advice, you need to say yes to the job or no to the job. And thereafter,
that's your control.
That's right. The gamble.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, I've had actors in before and you know, actors who are on stage in Broadway and other places, mm-hmm. not unlike you, where, you know, we have a conversation about rejection. Because it's a big part of being an actor. And I mean, and I think about it. Here you are on stage or, you know, at the Lyric and in you know, performing in front of 3,500 people, or you're on the big screen getting accolades for your work next to Hugh Jackman and Logan.
Mm-hmm.
But I would assume that part of the job that you had to learn at a certain point is how to handle rejection, because not every script goes your way, not every audition goes your way. Even things that you are in charge, you feel like you did well, don't necessarily come.
Yeah, to fruition. That part never stops. And I think that when people have, well, I don't think you can give anybody advice, but when young actors have said to me, you know, you're so old now, what is your advice? And I've just said, get used to having no tattooed invisibly on people's foreheads, because generally that is the word that you hear more than anything. People just say, no, we don't want you. We don't want you, Justin. We want Justin, the younger Justin, the Justin with more hair on top and no beard. We want a thinner Justin. We want a darker Justin. We want an older, you know, it's...
You sound like my parents.
Yeah, exactly. You know, well, no, so trying to, you can only, you know, you can only do your best in front of what they're asking for. So
is there a time, you know, as an actor in your life, I mean, that you become more comfortable with that or understand the dynamics of that?
Because you understand it. You have to understand it and accept it, because if you don't, you won't psychologically have the wherewithal to survive the amount of rejection that you get. And you never really stop auditioning because, you know, as you mentioned, having been in the played a villain in Logan with Hugh Jackman, that doesn't automatically mean theoretically, oh, well, now I'm going to be offered that part or that part. It just, you know, nothing follows according to what you think it logically should. So, you know, you can have something that 5 years later, somebody says, oh, I heard you on that show, on Justin's show, talking about this, and that gave me an idea for this. Could you come and play this part? And that's as arbitrarily as how things happen, genuinely.
You've had success with Nail and I as well, of having your first film, 1987, 30 years, congratulations on the anniversary. But that's a movie in which your character and the movie has a cult following, especially in England. Like, there's a large cult following. So talk about that dynamic as well, the idea of creating work, creating art, that actually, you know, beyond everything you just mentioned and, you know, how difficult this job can be, actually stays with people, becomes part of their lives.
That's a bonus when something like that happens. And I went to the Music Box, had a 30th anniversary screening of it a couple of weeks ago, which I went to, and I was astonished, having never been to Chicago before. You can imagine, if you come from another continent and you arrive here and a packed cinema and people laughing and having seen a movie that you had made 30 years ago that you've, you know, it's almost forgotten in your head, that they know all the dialogue from and they quote from, and then they ask very informed questions at the end of it when you do the live Q&A. That is very odd, because it's something that obviously with any cult thing, and I know from being a fan of movies and of particular performances, you can remember every detail, and then I've met the people that have played them. I remember meeting Peter O'Toole and asking about Lawrence of Arabia, and he looked at me like I was sort of mentally retarded, like, why are you talking about that? It's like 100 years ago, I can't even remember it. But, you know, in my mind, he is forever that. So I think there is an element of, and I've spoken to Tim Curry about this as well, from his iconic role in playing Frankfurter in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, is that at some level, people who are obsessed with one particular role in a movie that you've been in never quite forgive you for not playing that for the rest of your career or being that person in real life. Yeah. Now, I played an out-of-work, drug-addicted, alcoholic actor. I'm allergic to alcohol. And I, you know, since that movie came out 30 years ago, I've essentially been pretty much in work ever since. So the irony of that has not escaped me whatsoever. So I'm very grateful to it.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you here. Richard E. Grant, the great award-winning actor, is in town playing Professor Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady at the Lyric, running through May 21st. We just saw you on the screen as Dr. Xander Rice in the X-Men franchise, the movie Logan. Richard, thanks so much for coming in and being my guest.
Thank you, Justin. Appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Great to have Richard E. Grant in studio, huh?
Wow.
I forgot. We didn't even get a chance. If we could do another hour with him, I would just do his star turn in Hudson Hawk. Yeah, which he was nominated for a Raspberry, the worst supporting actor. Is Bruce Willis in Hudson Hawk? I can't remember if he was in that. Anyway. I also, L.A. Story. When I was a kid, I loved that movie. There was something about that Steve Martin project. It was like it was his love letter to Victoria Tennant, who was his wife at the time. And it was this sort of parody of L.A.
and everything that was happening there, but trying to almost putting a Shakespeare play. He had a lot of allegories to that. Like, it was just a big, like, it was almost Rick Moranis has a great scene as the gravedigger, and he grabs the skull, and everything is like, he overwrote it, Steve Martin, in a classic way that it I don't think it stands the test of time, but he plays, Richard plays a, I think Victoria Tennant's boyfriend in the movie. And I just remember, like, he was really funny because they went to the art museum. He did everything. He was like the foil, in a way, to Steve Martin. But yeah, very good movie. Do you remember that movie?
Yeah, yeah. Now, we were trying to revisit it recently. It's one of those, you know, it's another one of these things where if you can't find it in like 3 minutes, you fling the remote, you know, throw the remote at the TV.
It makes you so angry that they have all these movies and all everything, and then you're like, oh, I'm going to use this technology, and I'm going to spend my money wisely on a movie I'd like to watch right now. Oh, they don't have that one. They got Harry Potter 4, but they don't got that one.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Although it's kind of changed a bit now. It's easier to find because you had the old Comcast with this search on demand with the, you know, they had the 20, you know, the 26 yeah. letters, and you have to like yeah. scroll through. It's now such a pain in the butt. Now you do the voice thing.
Does it work for you?
Sometimes. Like you'll see like, you know, Chicago Bulls and it'll say like balls.
Chicago Bulls, Gary's popcorn? No.
So then we play around with it and say funny words and see what it comes up with.
You're getting your money's worth with the X1 package. I just signed up for Hulu the first time in my television watching mm-hmm. career. And I did it mostly for Handmaid's Tale, which is really, really good. That's a great show.
It's supposed to be great.
You,
Peggy Olson, right?
As the misogynist as I know you, you're going to love it. You're going to love it. No, yeah, Peggy Olson, she's so good. The only issue I have with it, for people who have seen it, is they're really into like the profile close-up two-shot where it's just, what's her name, Elizabeth Moss? Is that her name?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's just her face, you know, sort of like, freaked out at what's happening, but it's just really close up, and then you'll have like some mysterious music, and it's but they love that shot. They overuse it. By episode 3, like, all right, I don't need to be that close. They really like that shot.
Yeah, I gotta see. Do you have the ads? Did you get the because it's like $8.99 then $9.99 for no ads?
But what do you think I did? I'll take limited ads.
But just wait, if you have it for a little while and you find another, like, it's difficult people will be on there coming up so shortly, you're gonna get sick of the ads.
Oh, great.
You'll pay the extra buck or whatever it is.
I also saw it said you could add Showtime to the mix, right? And I was like, this is great because I really want to see Twin Peaks.
Yeah.
Like, I don't have Showtime, but I want to see the Twin Peaks reboot, which is coming up here. And I was like, this is great for a dollar more. But then I figured out, no, it was $8.99 plus another $8.99. So it's essentially Showtime just the same at Comcast or Hulu or mm-hmm. whatever. It's the same price. But I was like, oh, I'd love to see. You and I both share this, but we love Twin Peaks, and I would love to see that reboot. That's something I want to see.
We have Showtime, so come on over.
Yeah, all right.
Get a party going.
Done. It's going to be a rager. We'll have to watch all the VHS tapes of the first Twin Peaks. That's the one thing on Hulu. They had the entire first two seasons of Twin Peaks. I'm like, I went to the Dollar Video on Ashland when I was 22 years old, and I found they had the series, so we rented every single VHS. Like, we stacked it. Like, it was one of those things, like, it was a $20 rental.
Yes.
And we just stacked them, and we watched for a week, and we binge-watched VHS. And whenever they would get the scenes with the old fisherman and his Asian wife, we would fast-forward. We're like, we don't have time for that. We know that that's not, like... And they're like, oh, back up. No, they're back to Laura Palmer. He's like trying to get like, it's so good. All right, coming up, Chef Kerry Nahabedian in studio, the Hall of Fame chef. This is great. I'm so happy to talk to her. Excited. It's been, we've had a lot of chefs on the show, but she's one of the premier chefs in Chicago. Like I said, a Hall of Famer. She has a day named after her. That's pretty big deal, right? We'll talk with her coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, our old pal Barry Sterner is going to be here. We'll talk about. I'm interested in this idea that the economy is showing no growth. It continues to go down, yet the idea of raising interest rates is still on the table. And it's just this sort of figuring out the dichotomy between if it's all just, you know, bluster and show, and how much of it is really based on the numbers that come out when they start to affect the interest rate for your credit card, for your mortgage rate, things like that. So Barry's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. And then let's play I Never in the 10 o'clock. You want to do that? We'll bring that back. We got some prizes to give away as well. It's a download. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up, Barry Sterner is going to join us from Townstone. Talk about the interest rates. As I said, right before the news, I myself am head-scratching the idea that the numbers come out for the first quarter of the economy. They're not as good as expected, yet we still today, I'm hearing that the Fed's going to raise interest rates. You know, that they're going to move forward with that. And I want to know how much of that is bravado. We said we're going to do that. And how much of that is actually a plan to improve what happened in the first quarter of our economy. We'll talk with Barry about that. Coming up here in the 9 o'clock hour. And in 10 o'clock hour, we'll play I Never. Occasionally, we play I Never. Here's a good one for you. I never have played golf in my life. I've never played. And I almost had the chance. I was in California not too long ago, and my brother was like, let's go hit the golf course, and it rained, and we didn't do it. So I came this close to breaking that. So we'll play that at 10 o'clock for prizes, 312-981-7200. We always get great ones. The woman said, never been in a movie theater. I was like, what? He had a lot of never drank, never done drugs, things like that come up. So we'll get to all that coming up in the 10 o'clock hour. Well, my next guest is a Chicago Hall of Famer. Seriously, 2009, Chef Carrie Nahabedian was inducted into the Chicago Culinary Museum and Chef's Hall of Fame. Mayor Daley even named a day after her, and it's all earned. Nahabedian is a longtime chef. Her restaurant, Naha, opened in 2000 in the old Gordon space on Clark Street. And in more recent years, she opened Brondi, just up the block. She's been recognized with a Michelin star. She won the James Beard Award for Best Chef, Great Lakes. And she has a career of firsts, including being the first woman in the kitchen at Le Francais in Wheeling. A fine dining juggernaut and pioneer, Chef Carrie Nahabedian, in studio tonight. Chef, thanks for being here. Appreciate it. Great to meet you. Thank you.
Great being here. Thanks so much for having me.
So I read you start when everyone else was going off and having fun at age 17, you got into food. What brought you to wanting to work in restaurants?
I was always, you know, I grew up in an Armenian family, so it's food, food, food. Even when you're eating food, you're looking for what are we going to do for the next meal. And I was always a creative force. That's what my parents tell me to this day, that I was very different at a young age. And I owe it all to my, work program teacher at Maney's High School in Park Ridge, that there was a food class and it allowed me to work in an environment where food was produced. And luckily for me, my father was doing the carpet for Marshall Fields at the Ritz-Carlton. And he's a combat wounded World War II veteran. So all the chefs were French. So he spoke French to them. And nothing anyone likes better than to meet someone that helped save them. And he was in Normandy and he was in Paris. And so he spoke French to them and said, my daughter's crazy about cooking. And that's how it all started. I was 17. I had to wait till I was 17. And I took a bus, two trains, and worked 6 days a week in high school and worked at the Ritz. Now, you wouldn't really necessarily be able to do that, because I think the schools are a little more stricter than they were.
You know, for people who know the culinary world, I mean, that almost is something that rarely happens anymore. The idea that chefs start in hotels. The Ritz-Carlton is considered to be one of the best training grounds for some of the renowned chefs, not just here in Chicago, but around the country. And you think of Four Seasons, other places like that. Talk about the experience, what you learned from working in a hotel before you worked in your own restaurant.
Well, I'll tell you that we always say that everyone great. That Four Seasons managed the Ritz-Carlton up until a couple of years ago, and now it's reverted back to its original Ritz-Carlton. So we always used to say in Four Seasons that everyone great passed through, had to pass through the Ritz, because it was such an exceptional training ground. If you think about Sarah Stegner and George Mombaris up north, combined the two of them, 52 years at the Ritz. And just the other day, I saw Richie Warren, who's the banquet chef. He's been there since day one. He always credits the Ritz for taking him off the street, that he's 61 years old. And he said, "This, they made my career." So I would say what I learned most is you learn organization, and you learn that you are just part of everyone's success, that if there's a weak link in a hotel, you're going to find it straight out of the gate. And there was so much to learn. At 17 years old, I would just come home. I couldn't even go to sleep at night because I couldn't wait to go back. School was just, for me, it was just something off to the side. Like, you know, I had found my calling really early on. I was very lucky. And we always say that hotel chefs will say it's easy to become a restaurant chef after you've run a hotel, but it's very difficult to be a restaurant chef and then become an executive chef of a hotel.
Just because it's a whole different beast?
It's a whole different beast, and you're also dealing with so many different types of clientele. And with Four Seasons, I was only an executive chef for Four Seasons, so I only know that type of clientele. That's my claim, as I always say to my father, I'm a product of my environment. If I had been chef of a Holiday Inn, it'd be a different story. But this is what I learned. And what I learned was the guest is in your home. So treat them with the best hospitality. Treat them as if they were, as if it was you, that you were experiencing, you would want greatness. And to have that level of excellence, to exceed their expectations every single minute.
You know, because you bounced through, you did, just following your career, I mean, you were the executive chef at Four Seasons, and you made a name for yourself, not just here, but in L.A. Talk about what brought you back here, and what was it about opening your own restaurant?
Well, I'll tell you, my cousin Michael and I, we are business partners at Nahum Brandy, and he always thought it was a joke when I left to go to California. Okay, so when are you coming back? And I initially thought, okay, I'll be there for a couple of years. But as everyone knows, if you go to California, chances are you're not coming back, because it is paradise there. And you're working and you're getting paid, and it's so beautiful. But Chicago's my home. This is where my family is. And I'll tell you how it all happened is that Charlie Trotter said to me one day at an event, he said, Gordon, he whispered in my ear, Gordon's going to retire, and I think Gordon Sinclair is going to retire, and I think you need that spot. I think it's time you come back to Chicago. And Michael Michael kept thinking it was a joke. At first, I was 5 years in Santa Barbara at the iconic Biltmore, which, if anyone's gone to Santa Barbara, and I, if you haven't gone, well, then you're really missing out on one of the greatest things in life. And then I was in L.A., and Michael would call me almost every day and say, okay, the joke's over, when you're coming home. So once I heard about Gordon, I went to Michael, and he himself started the process of, and then it was a collaboration between his brother Tom, my cousin Tom Nahabedian, who is the architect and designer of both Nahum Brandy. And we're one of the few families that have multiple James Beard Awards, because Tom won for best design for Brandy 2 years ago right here in Chicago.
Wow.
So it was, that's how it all started.
That's amazing. Chef Carrie Nahabedian in studio. Of course, her restaurant Naha over on Clark Street, right across the street from Rick Bayless. He talked about that block, the Clark Street block, when he was in here last week before his event. So much has changed in that area. I mean, even from 2000, he was talking about 1987, but you know,
if you talk to Jim Flynn from the Baton, he'd tell you what it was like 50 years ago. So there you go.
You know, you got to know the history of your block, right? But I mean, talk about that. I mean, not just with Clark Street, but that area. I mean, you think about River North and Hubbard Street and everything. It has changed dramatically, even from the year 2000 when you guys started. Talk about how Chicago has changed and that area has changed when it comes to fine dining, when it comes to restaurants.
Well, Rick was really happy to have us as a neighbor, and I will tell you that it was Mangiano's, us, and, you know, Topolo Bombo and Frontera, and that was just about it. I mean, the Boss Bar and a couple little, you know, dive places up the street, kind of places that all of us would go to at the end of work to relax. There wasn't any restaurants. There really wasn't. And also, I think I counted the other day that 17 high-rises have gone up since in 17 years, not including, you know, right across the street from you, the Trump Tower and all the construction. It's just been mind-boggling. We have three hotels across the street from us, and there isn't one open area in River North anymore. And when we got there, there was just enormous expanses of land. And soon the post office is going to go away. So who knows what that's going to be.
Well, I
will tell you, it's a lot of competition. I mean, there is – Let Us Entertain You has 10 restaurants that weren't there 5 years ago.
Well, I mean, I would always say, I mean, it's amazing. I guess restaurants go where the people are. I mean, to say 17 towers, including the Trump Tower and everything that's happened in terms of building real estate in that area, does that help you in terms of – people coming into hotels and people coming down for tourism to Hubbard Street to come into Naha to be a part of it? Or does it mean it adds competition and there are more restaurants that are catering for those
Well,
palates?
I think the pie gets smaller and smaller as it goes along. And just like with all the luxury hotels, every new hotel takes away a little bit of business. But I'll say that unless someone tells me that, oh, I'm staying at the Aloft or I'm staying down the street at the Hyatt or something, we don't necessarily know unless, of course, the concierge calls us. Then we can track that. But there is a lot more foot traffic. We would, of course, love a little bit more police presence in River North because there is an enormous amount of crowds, especially on the weekend. And Naha, 17 years, we're in that stage of marriage in the restaurant industry that is that rarefied air. Once you get over 15 years,
yeah, right?
People are amazed. And, you know, I marvel at restaurants that restaurant that just closed up in Bridgeport that had been there 100 years or
Shallard's,
something like that.
Yeah.
It's just crazy.
That,
but
yeah.
It doesn't get any easier. People think it's so easy to run a restaurant, but it gets harder and harder. And just like you were saying about people never had this or never had that, we get people who come in and they're like, I've never been to your restaurant. And you're like, okay. So there's still people out there 17 years in that haven't been, and
well,
I love that.
This town, it's hard to believe being a lifelong Chicagoan, but this town has become a mecca of sorts for fine dining. And the restaurants that continue to win, you saw last week with the James Beers, but the restaurants not unlike yours, but with Grant Achatz and Curtis Duffy and the others that are elevating fine dining to an art form where people are coming in and they don't even order anything. They just, you know, here comes the food. It's almost like a play. But you have still done the restaurant with the three-course meal. You've still done it the sort of more traditional way. Yet you compete with those restaurants. Talk about why. You know, where you stand with the sort of artistry that's happening with all the sort of new restaurants in Chicago versus what you've done at Naha for 17 years.
Well, I will say that I have nothing against walking into a restaurant and someone saying to me, this is the menu for this evening. It leaves you no decision to be made. And if you have an allergy, well, then you should have said something long before. But I will tell you that Michael and I had one rule when we opened Naha, and that was the lunch menu wasn't available at dinner and the dinner menu wasn't available at lunch.
Right on.
And even then, we still broke the rules for people that couldn't come in for dinner time. But we're individuals that we like a certain style. Michael's a bar guy. He loves to eat at the bar. He loves great cocktails. He loves the wine program. So we have an enormous selection for people to choose from, that we have a great bar menu. Lunch will reopen soon as the construction on Clark Street that's been going on for 6 months stops, because it's right in front of our front door. But we do one of the best lunches in the city. But we have tasting menus at both restaurants. We have a la carte dining, a la carte desserts. We have cheese courses. You can do it all. You can have a five-course tasting menu. You want 9, 10 courses. You can have whatever you like. At Brandy, we do a French regional tasting menu that changes every month or so, and it features different regions of France, as well as 8 or 9 courses. We really just leave it in the guests' hands, because I will say that I like the idea. Our guests love to be able to come in, and maybe we don't make as much money as everybody else does, but I will say that I sleep well at night knowing that if a guest wants to come in and have 2 appetizers and dessert and not have an entree, I'm cool with that.
You're cool with it. My last question, just based on, you know, looking at your Twitter feed. So you have Naha, you have Brandy, you have, you know, James Beard's Awards, you have Michelin stars, Hall of Fame, you got a day named after you. Yet tomorrow night you're going to be at an Armenian church. Is it a church that at 6700 West, cooking up Armenian food?
So, well, I am Armenian, both my parents, and really old school. My parents live in Florida. They're married 68 years. And our church, St. Gregory the Illuminator, is in Chicago almost 100 years. And our late grandfather and grandmother, you know, they were part of the Armenians that came and settled in Chicago. So we are doing a heritage program, like talking about the legacy of what Armenians are to, what is Armenian cuisine, what Armenians can bring to the table in terms of not just Oriental rugs. Oscar Totosian is going to talk about rugs next month, but I'm cooking with 2 women who came with their families that just came to the United States from Armenia, and we're going to cook Armenian food.
Give us real quick, just sort of like one signature dish that would be Armenian food.
Oh, well, you know, that's the thing, that there isn't one signature dish, because it is just like Chicago's melting pot. The Middle East, people came, and what you thought was Armenian cuisine is actually, it could be defined as Turkish, could be Persian cuisine. So I'm doing a really awesome spice lamb boreg with dried fruits, with the Rumi spice saffron, which has a great story, which you probably have heard about, the women, service women that were in the war in Afghanistan for the Americans, and they saw the women in the villages in Afghanistan without husbands, and they had nothing to farm, and they used to farm saffron. And so, long story short, they're going to be on Shark Tank tomorrow. And Rumi saffron is, we're going to do a Greek yogurt with Rumi saffron. We're doing toasted pine nuts, arugula salad. It's free. It's at 6700 West Diversity. And it's come learn about our church. We have the best Armenian fest in the whole Midwest. That is August 12th and 13th.
Well, I have to say, I mean, probably the best church potluck. When you have Chef Carrie Nahavedian, a James Beard Award winner, as well as her restaurant Naha has a Michelin star. She's in the Chicago Culinary Museum and Chef's Hall of Fame. She's had a day named after her from Mayor Daley. Chef, a pleasure to have you here. Thanks so much for coming in and talking about your food and your restaurant. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it.
How about that, Rob? You get a little, just want to go to the Armenian church over at 6700 Diversity. And then you're like, oh, it's a James Beard Award-winning chef cooking lamb tonight.
I'm in.
That's pretty great, right?
Touched by God. The plates got to be good. Actually, you know what? I enjoyed that interview. I would check that out, definitely.
I mean, if you go to Naha, which is in the Gold Coast here, or in the River North, you go in there, and it's gonna be a pretty penny. It's a nice place. I mean, it's fine dining. But if you really want to taste, you know, the work of a award-winning chef, hey. Go to the basement at the church tomorrow night.
I'm always up for that.
You know what I mean? Maybe we could do a remote, you know?
I'm in. Let's do it.
I'll see if we can get that done in under 24 hours. But we'll see. It's Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up at 10 o'clock, I'm excited about this. Mary said she has to go to bed, but she gave me this, which is awesome. She's never owned a car with automatic door locks or windows. Wow. I got to say, it should be called Never Have I Ever, right? That's the game. never have I ever, and that's usually a body, you know, raunchy game. But this is a little bit different, but that's perfect. I've never owned a car with automatic door locks or windows. Wow. I mean, think about that. That means that, Mary, your cars would have been, you can't even choose it. It's not like that's on the checklist when you go to the Honda dealer. Can I get the manual locks? I mean, like, what's that? I love it. I love this game. 312-981-7200. The best ones, we got prizes to give away to tonight. That's coming up at 10 o'clock. 312-981-7200. As I mentioned, you know, I'm very interested. I've been talking about this the entire show. This the concept of where we are with the economy. Today, we saw so many different stories that you know, are very important to the future of who we are as a people, as the United States of America. But I saw last week a story that kind of got brushed over, and it was this idea that the first quarter economy numbers, the economic numbers that came under the first quarter of Donald Trump, were way lower than expected. And it's interesting because that's what he ran on. This is the idea that he's a business president and he's going to turn the economy around. And one of the ways he did that, says he's going to do that, is by raising the interest with the Fed raising the interest rate. And we saw that happen, and today I heard a story saying, you know what, they're going to do it again. It has to. It's the only way that we're going to bolster the economy. And Pete and I were talking about the idea that we don't even know why that is. At a certain point, you're like, what does that have to do with me? When the interest rate gets raised, that means mortgages and credit cards get theirs. But I'm not sure what I get out of the deal. Barry Sterner is in studio. He is the founder of Townstone Financial, a mortgage lending company here in Chicago. Good to see you, Barry.
Thanks for having me.
So I turn to you for this. This is something that became a head scratcher and I want to talk about. So the Fed did increase the rate one time already, and we have seen an increase, and they're going to do it again. Why?
Well, you know, the Federal Reserve is looking out ahead in the future. So you, myself, and Pete, we don't know exactly what they're looking at. Because if you look at the numbers that you said for the first quarter, tomorrow is an unemployment report, by the way. Tomorrow is going to be April unemployment. It's a big unemployment report. I'm sure the Trump administration wants a better number than they had at March.
It's sort of moving that it looks like it's going to be a better situation than the last at least 2 weeks when it comes to the
right. The ADP came out yesterday. I think it's like 175 or 200,000. I don't know the exact number, but it was a better number. You know, the street is looking and saying, hey, March was not good, but some of these adjustments that are done by the labor statistics in Washington, which, by the way, supposedly doesn't have enough people working at it right now because the Trump administration hasn't hired them. You know, they're saying to themselves, if this is a really good number and the Federal Reserve looks at it that way and it comes to where everyone's expecting it, you're going to see another quarter point up here at the next Federal Reserve meeting. I think it's in a month and a half or 2 months is the next meeting. However, you know, you're asking the real important thing is, and I get this phone call all the time, how does it affect us? When it went up a quarter point, like you were saying, my mortgage statement didn't go up. However, if you had a home equity line of credit, it directly affected you. In the next month, right, you were paying an extra quarter point. If you're going to get a car loan, okay, any type of car financing, you paid an extra quarter point. If you had a CD that was coming up at the bank, you had a savings account, generally speaking, eventually, and we were talking about this before, it doesn't happen automatically. Like they charge you automatically, but they don't right. raise it a quarter point on your CD and your savings account that quickly. But that's really what it's affecting. But here's the real interesting thing, and I think, and we've talked about this before, the real interesting thing is that since they raised, we've had political things that you've talked about. You got problems going on in North Korea. You have problems going on in Washington, or I should say nothing's going on in Washington. You haven't had any real tax cut movement. Obamacare until today, it passed the House, obviously. There was no movement there. And people are starting to question, is he really going to be able to move the economy? Is the president going to be able to move the economy? So despite the fact that the Federal Reserve rate is a quarter point, actual 30-year mortgage interest rates, 15-year mortgage interest rates, they haven't really moved much. We've been trading on a 10-year bond between 2.30, which means nothing to the majority of people, and 2.60. All I want to say is we've been bouncing between this 30 basis point spread going on 3 months now.
So So let me get this straight. So the idea that the Fed increases the rate, we're all told that you better get in. This is going to screw up refinancing. This is going to change the way you get a mortgage. It's just going to go up, and it hasn't. Why hasn't it?
The Federal Reserve does not control long-term mortgage rates. When the Federal Reserve raises interest rates by a quarter point, that is actually the amount of money, or shall I say, the interest rate that the large banks pay to borrow overnight. And you say, why do the banks borrow overnight? There's a million reasons why they borrow overnight. It's because of the way that how deposits are. But the bottom line is, right now they're paying 1% overnight to borrow. And so the Federal Reserve can raise rates up and mortgage rates can still go down. So I call it hyperbole, because when you hear on TV and they're talking about Federal Reserve, it really scares everybody. It's like crying wolf. I'm not saying rates aren't going to go up, but they just haven't, because we're in a world economy. I know I was in here a couple years ago when the Chinese government devalued and there was all kinds of things going on in China and our stock market went down, and the Federal Reserve was talking about increasing rates at that time, and the actual mortgage rates did not go up. What really made mortgage rates go up, and it's kind of silly to say, but the night that Donald Trump won, we went up steadily. We were at 3.25 to 3.5 on a 30-year fix, and we went to about 4.25. We went a point up within, I don't want to say 60 days.
Because
of politics and the way that, you know, he was talking about borrowing billions and billions of dollars to build all these roads. Not that any place in Chicago needs the roads fixed, as you know, or the CTA or the schools or anything else needs fixing. He was going to spend all this money and get all these things through Congress. And you've talked about it many nights on this program, which I listen to. Nothing's really happened. So we're kind of stuck and we're not moving right now. And, you know, it's a great time to buy. We're still around 4% on a 30-year fix. We've been bouncing between 3.75 and 4.25. So still very low. We were just talking about your past guest, the first house that they bought. Or her parents bought was at 20%. Mine was at 12%. And, you know, right now, if you talk about 4.25 versus 3.75, everybody gets all crazy. Yeah, right. It's a half a point up.
It's funny. I think my first condo, which probably would have been early 2000s, was five and a quarter.
And you were able to buy it. You were able to afford it.
Yeah. It's interesting. But Barry Sterner's in studio. He is the founder of Townstone Financial. We're talking about the Fed, whether or not they're going to raise the interest rate. But I also think one of the big economic stories, as we talk more about finance, has to do with what we saw sort of flirting around the edges, and President Trump has talked about the concept and the notion of breaking up the big banks. We see this all the time, and I even saw, you know, more billionaires talking about it. You know, Griffin here in Chicago was quoted saying, I think it's a great idea. You're hearing more and more people saying it's great. What does that mean to when a politician says they want to use the government to break up the big banks?
Well, you know, I was watching Barney Frank on CNBC, who obviously one of the co-writers of the Dodd-Frank bill. And he was talking about the fact that since 2008, when this bill came out, that the banks, some of them have doubled and tripled in size. And we're talking about the major ones. You got Bank of America, Chase, who else? PNC, Wells Fargo.
Yeah.
Some of the largest banks in the country right now. And the threat is, what happens if something goes bad, like it did in 2008? Who's going to bail out these gigantic institutions?
Because now they're bigger than they ever.
Now they're bigger than they ever are. And for myself, my personal opinion, you know, I worry if any of them goes out, my 401k, my IRA, all my retirement money, my business here, we're all going to have a problem, because there's systemic reaction. They're all intertwined right now. However, the big banks are going to say to you, how am I going to compete with the Germans? How am I going to compete with the Chinese? How am I going to compete with the Japanese bank if you cut me down and make me smaller? Because it's a large world banking system out there, and I am in competition with these other large entities, and if you chop me in half, I can't compete.
I'm just interested because I think about the rhetoric that comes out of the Trump administration, in a good way or bad way. I don't discern one way or the other. The concept that regulation is strangling business. It's not giving Americans a chance. We really want to get the government out of banking. We hear that about Wall Street as well. So it seems to me on the wrong side to say that they want to break anything up, because it seems to be the government interfering in capitalism at its strongest.
Listen, you know, I'm a small businessman. I've been in business. It's going to be 15 years in July. Townsend Financial. You know, we've made it through. Washington Mutual no longer exists. Bear Stearns no longer exists. All because of mortgages, right? And Dodd-Frank, although it solved many, many problems, it went all the way too far for, I guess, the majority of, I want to say the majority of Americans. You know, when you have a crisis, you come in and you try to stop the bleeding. Okay, so it stopped the bleeding. But I'm positive right now. I mean, I'm hopeful, I should say. I'm hoping that Trump comes in there and the Trump administration and some cooler heads come in and say, hey, Obamacare, Dodd-Frank, we did them at a time of crisis, and let's fix them. Let's make them better. Right now, there are certain people that call me up I can't get mortgages for. They don't fit in the box. And the box is very, very tight. It's been very, very tight since 2008.
That's what people who work in the mortgage industry complain about, the idea that there are too many regulations on who can get what kind of mortgage.
Exactly. And so if we can just open it up and have a little more common sense. I mean, there are such things as bankers knowing who I can give a loan to. For instance, you could have a 50% loan to value, meaning your house could be worth $200,000. You could only owe $100,000, and maybe you need to cash out and you want to go to $125,000. However, you may be retired. You may not have a whole lot of assets. I can't even qualify you anymore based on your loan to value.
No, I'll play devil's
and
advocate.
And I can't get you a loan.
To my mortgage broker in studio. One of the reasons the regulations was on there is because the mortgage industry had figured out a way to give unqualified people mortgages at an alarming rate for commissions and what have you. And they started to default and it started a chain reaction and got us to where we were in 2008. So, I think that has become sort of the layman understanding of the economy. So when you talk about, just give us a bigger box, you're sort of like, how big is too big?
It was too big. Stated income, stated assets, stated this, meaning you, let's call it a lawyer's loan. Let's call it the way it was. It was a lawyer's loan. That started out very innocently. It started out for a self-employed borrower who was using the tax code and not, he had their business, such as me, a small businessman, and I don't show any income because I write everything off.
Right.
I couldn't get a loan. So they started doing some kind of stated income for a self-employed person. And that particular person had cash flow, money coming in, and it was used properly. And as you said, that sprung into teachers, police officers, firemen, you know, everybody had second and third jobs, and it wasn't used properly. I always go back to the same thing, and I have this argument all the time with people. The regulators did not regulate. There were plenty of laws around in 2007, 2008, 2006.
They looked the other way.
And that includes the Federal Reserve that we were talking about. They went in and looked at these bank books. They were doing stated income loans and all the rest, and they allowed it to happen. So when the regulations are on the books, enforce them, period. And right now, I'm not talking about opening it wide open. I'm just talking about making some smart, common sense changes so that certain self-employed people, certain retired people, certain people that work really, really hard. The average American who's working really, really hard, who maybe has a couple dings on their credit, something happened to them medically-wise or something like that, and I can't qualify them right now. And so for us to be able to use some common sense, our industry, and maybe some people are listening and saying, well, the whole entire banking industry doesn't ever have common sense, so it's hard to do. I would beg to differ that we do have some common sense and to be able to do this, because to go to work every day and say no to many of these people, some of them are hurting. And I'm not just saying that. Some of them are hurting. They need to refinance. They need cash. They want, or some of them want to buy their first house, and they're loaded up with student loan debt. And some of these things are opening up a little bit. Those are the people I'm talking about helping. I'm not saying stated income, you get a loan, everyone gets a loan who wants a loan. Just something to open up the box just a couple inches.
Always good to talk. Barry Sterner, the founder of Townstone Financial, joins us from time to time to talk about the economic outlook and interest rates here, not only in Chicago, but the country. Barry, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
I appreciate it. If you need to reach me, give me a shout, 312-896-2110. We'll be in the office tomorrow.
All right, coming up, let's play I Never, 312-981-7200. We have some prizes to give away. Complimentary registration to the Bike to Drive, MB Bike to Drive. It means you don't have to pay to do the what I think is one of the coolest things Chicago has to offer. How cool is that? You know, last year I got to MC the event, like down in the park, in Grant Park. But more so, I love the concept of, like, you know, being able to think outside the box about something cool and fun to do, and riding your bike on Lakeshore Drive is pretty cool, right? You've done it, right?
Yeah, of course.
Is it hard?
No, it's fun.
It just feels like it'd be like, oh, this is the easiest thing ever because I'm not in a car. And I would assume there's not like potholes and things like that because it's Lakeshore Drive, but I could be wrong.
It's a lot of fun. And we live like way north, so we drove all, like, we met people here at last year at WGN. So we got up like at 5, drove down here. Then you drive like all the way to the south side, like 47th Street.
And then drive.
And then we had to ride our bikes back. So we got back, you know, like on the return, we got back to around here and we're like, oh man, we still got to go home. Should we, like, you know, Uber or like see if they can take the bikes?
All right, then we got a complimentary registration to give away to our favorite I Never Have I Ever. We'll play it today, 312-981-7200. As Mary said, she never had a car with automatic locks or windows. As I said, I've never been golfing. I've never seen the movie Citizen Kane. Up to this week, I never saw My Fair Lady. That's done. I put that off the bucket list. I went and saw it, so it's all good. All right, we'll take a break. We'll come back. We'll get Rob's news. Stay with us. Never have I ever. Let's play 312-981-7200. I always have a lot of fun with this one. This is a little game that we play here on the download on occasion, and we want to bring it here for the summer now that we've got some more space to play with. Why not, right? Last time we did it, there were some great ones. I remember the woman who called in, I forgot her name, but she said she never have I ever been in a movie theater. And then she said that she went into the lobby to get popcorn to go, but she'd never actually gone into a movie.
That's weird.
It is weird. It's always, like, that's what I love about this segment, is you kind of go, wow, just like with Mary right at the top where she's like, I've never had a car. Never have I ever had a car with automatic locks and windows.
You have to go into a movie theater to experience how much going to the movies is terrible and other people are awful.
So this could be anything from, never, you know, like, this is really a segment that is dedicated and designed, really, for, you know, that sort of piece of pop culture. It's a confessional segment. It's that piece of pop culture that everybody's talked about and you missed. You know, that happens so often with movies. Like, I think of, like, just off the top of my head, I remember missing, we talked about at the beginning of the week. I missed all of the Harry Potter movies.
Yeah.
I've never read the books. I don't know the movies. I tried to get into it, but I think it was opposite Lord of the Rings at the time, and I was like, "Nah, I'll take my hobbits, my orcs, a little bit more, a little bit more about the siren eye than I am about wizardry."
My wife, I'm sure she's seen the Harry Potter movies, but also has read the books, and I know this because we're moving, and those books are huge. So it's like, stop making fun of me for, you know, having Mike Singletary's calling the shots. I'm still hanging out of that. These Harry Potter books
is
are
Mike Singletary
like,
calling the shots his autobiography?
I think so.
Is it really? Is he just like, and then this is a leadership. This is how you cross your eyes when it's 3rd and 1.
It came out like after the Super Bowl or something like that. But I mean, and those are they young adult books, the Harry Potter books?
Yeah, they're the most famous because I even remember when they came out, even when the movie came out, it was such a big deal to go and talk to kids who had read the books. Like, it was awesome to see. This was the quintessential, we're turning it into a movie. So, yeah, they were a huge deal, especially, like, for kids in middle school at that time.
But I mean, I know plenty of adults that love them as well.
You got a lot of dweeb friends. No, of course there were a lot of adults that read it as well. I mean, I think my father-in-law,
yeah,
has like the whole collection. Mm-hmm. Read them all. I don't know. Anyway, I had never ever seen Harry Potter until this weekend, until they did the marathon, and now I'm like more confused than ever. I'm like, oh, you know, it's really interesting. In I think it's movie 3 or movie 4, The Prisoner of Azkaban, one of the main characters, who's, I think he's only in it for this movie, is the guy who played Knox Harrington, the video artist in Lebowski.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you remember the guy? Yeah. Like, who's this? It's Sandra for the finale.
That's great.
Yeah. He's like grown up, and now he's like a Harry Potter professor. Yeah, so. All right. I digress. 312-981-7200. 217. I never have I ever been to Great America. That's a tough. I mean, I could see that. I would assume that that's. If you're not into roller coasters and, mm-hmm. and maybe you don't have kids, I don't know why you'd go anywhere near that park. I every time I go, I'm like. I gotta take long deep breaths.
You don't like it? You don't like the roller coasters?
I don't mind the roller coasters, I guess. They may just make you nauseous, mm-hmm. as James Comey. I'm mildly nauseous, like getting on the demon. I the whole experience of like having to wait in a long line and get in there and the experience being only 30 seconds.
Yeah.
I don't know.
I remember going as a kid, and it was, you know, like coming from the South Side, it was like a vacation day.
Yeah.
It was like we were psyched. We went to the Jewel and got our Coke can for the $10 off. Put on my best Van Halen T-shirt, you know, so I'm looking cool around the park. And then like later on in life, you meet, you know, like people for like you go to college and you meet people like me. Oh, I met a kid from Libertyville. Oh yeah, we used to go to Great America every day because we live 5 minutes away. What? And I was like, oh man, that would have been
those
the greatest.
Years. One of those years, I got a season pass. Mm-hmm. When I was 13. Got the pitcher and the whole bit.
Yeah,
and then I still don't think it worked out value wise for me. I don't think I went as many times as I thought I was going to go, but yeah, because I was pretty far away as well. But yeah, I don't know. We went to SeaWorld when I was in San Diego, and they had they've smartly started to transition that park into a roller coaster park, you know, because the whales just eat people, so they can't do that. Can't do that anymore. But so they're like, what do we make a whale roller coaster? Yay! I'll wait in line for it. But we waited in line, and it was hot. And you're just like, what am I doing? So I don't know. I can't. But I don't necessarily believe that one is like, oh my god, I can't believe you've never been to Great America. But anyway, 312-981-7200. Phone number. We're playing Never Have I Ever. Let's keep going here, and then we'll take a quick break. 224 says, never have I ever seen Grease or The Sound of Music. Wow. Those are like, you're missing a lot of network TV. You know what I mean? Like, you don't have to go, you really got to go out of your way to not get The Sound of Music. Just once, right?
Yeah, that's, what is it? It's always on around
Easter, yeah.
Easter,
yeah.
Thanksgiving.
Easter. I think it's an Easter thing.
Easter thing.
Maybe
it's
Easter. Yeah. You really got to go out of your way. Grease 2. I mean, I don't mean Grease 2 with Michelle Pfeiffer. I mean Grease T-O-O. That one was on all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny because that's the one movie. That's funny that they mentioned Grease because my son is playing Danny Zuko in the Grease play that's going to be on stage at the school.
Oh, that's a role.
It's a role, and I can tell the
starring role.
It's a starring role. Very excited about it. This is a good story. My uncle, his name is Guy Baril, and Guy Baril lives here in Chicago. He's a great actor. He used to be the joy of my day to wait for the Illinois Bell commercial, and he would pick up the phone in the Illinois Bell commercial, like, you know, when it would rain, like it was in commercials.
Yeah.
He had lines in movies, you know, and things like that. He was a Chicago actor.
Yeah.
And he was credited with being the first director of Grease when it was here in Chicago in the 60s at Kingston Mines. It was before the play went to Broadway, before the Broadway version became the movie. So, and his claim to fame, unfortunately, is that they didn't take him with from Chicago to Broadway, because that's what happens in that day, especially. We talked a little bit about that with Tracy Letts, the idea that they don't take the original people, and a lot, especially the directors, when they go to the bigger production. Money's on the line. So anyway, so I told my son that. I said, hey, you're going to be in Greece, which they have doctored up. I started to see the script. It's just like, you know, tell me more. Did you hold hands by the beach? Like, it's like everything you could possibly fourth grade it up. So they got rid of, they just sanitized it.
It's pretty racy.
Yeah, it is. I mean, even the play in Chicago is very racy. What they did to Broadway, they sanitized it. The movie, they sanitized it more. But you even got to go further, you know, for a fourth grade rendition. Anyway, I told him this. I told him the whole story of Uncle Guy, right? So he goes, and he goes to the teacher, you know, who's like, and he says to the teacher, hey, my uncle directed Grease, and he's got to come watch it. The teacher's like, what? Oh, I don't know if I can handle it. I'm like, well, first of all, I don't think he's coming to the play. I haven't asked him yet. And secondly, all right, slow your roll. Everyone, slow your roll. No one. This isn't Waiting for Guffman. We're not gonna find ourselves on a off Broadway rendition of the Grease, the fourth grade Grease. So anyway, that's
great.
So now I got to call my Uncle Guy and be like, hey, you got to come.
You got to come
see this fourth grade version. And he'll be like, eh, it's okay. It was okay. All right, we're playing Never Have I Ever, sort of. I kind of got off on a what it is. Never Have I Ever Seen Grease. We got a lot of texts that are coming in right now. 312-981-7200. We've got stuff to give away tonight. We'll give it away to our favorite Never Have I Ever here on the download. 312-981-7200. Stay with us. Playing Never Have I Ever here on the download. 312-981-7200. Got some good stuff, Pete. You're going to love it. We're giving away some prizes to the best ones tonight. And we got some good stuff. First off, 773 says, hey, I just saw your Uncle Guy. He said hello. Yeah. He said he asked about me. There you go. He also said that I'm not going to talk about his health. He texted me when his health situation. All right. I'm going to broadcast on WGN Radio what's going on with Uncle Guy. All right. Let's see. 224 says, never have I ever been to a live rock star concert. Wow. So like a live, you just mean like a rock and roll concert? Wow.
So probably a bad week for that person a couple of weeks ago doing the Facebook thing. Couldn't come up with the 10 concerts.
Right. Which one is fake? Oh, they're all fake. All right. If you said that. 815 says, never been to Las Vegas.
Ah.
That's true. I bet you that's pretty normal. I mean, it's expensive to go out to Las Vegas, and I don't think everybody and their brother goes there, right? Have you been to Las Vegas?
I have, yeah, and I'm not a gambler, but it's like kind of one of those things that you just, I think it was for a bachelor party or something, you know, you had to go out there and kind of a rite of passage.
It was like you did the plot to the movie, what's the movie, Hangover?
Hangover?
Yeah. Sure. 630 says, as a 52-year-old, I regret never going to Old Chicago. Old Chicago, is that like a theme park? Does he mean old? What is that?
Yeah, that was the. It was an indoor theme park.
Yeah,
it was out in, I want to say, Bolingbrook, perhaps.
Old Chicago. Is that what are we barking up the right tree? 630. Is that what you mean by old Chicago? I mean, I don't want to date myself. I'm 42.
Yeah,
The idea. As a 52-year-old, regret never going to Old Chicago.
I think it was an indoor amusement park.
Huh. Someone will tell us, yeah. 630 says, I never found out who or what Harambe was. That's pretty good, right? That is a good one. 224 says, I never have I ever finished Super Mario Brothers on Nintendo. Wow. That's going deep. I got to say, I don't know if I ever finished it. I feel like... that's a problem I have right now as well, because my son has Nintendo Wii, and he'll play a game, and I don't know if he plays it to completion, meaning I don't think it's to the end, to the last level. You know, get to a certain point, he gets bored of it, and then we never hear of the game again. You know, I don't know. I think like Zelda, like the Nintendo game of Zelda, like that was one that you needed to get to the end because it like just was a story that kept telling itself. But I feel like Super Mario Brothers would be like, nah, you know what? So I never got to fight Bowser. Big deal. 224 says, I've never seen a James Bond movie. Wow. I would be kind of with you, but my buddy Adam and my buddy Tommy made me watch one night, and I watched one of the Daniel Craig ones. It was pretty good. I forgot which one it was, but so it didn't really have that much of an impression. Let's go to the phones. Veronica, yes. Veronica.
Yes.
You want to play Never Have I Ever? Or you actually have an ever. You saw something. You saw the original Grease.
I did, and it was wonderful. Far superior to the movie, and the director in Kingston Mines was great, and the actors were great, but I did not care for the movie.
There you go. See, he'll love to hear that.
Yes,
because
yes.
I've heard that it was a different type of show. I mean,
totally.
When it went to Broadway, they kind of made it a different story and everything. But
very
it was
true, very true. No, it was excellent. The director was great, and the actors were great.
All right.
That's all I wanted to say.
All right, Veronica, thanks for calling. I appreciate
You're
that.
Welcome.
I'll pass that on to Uncle Guy. Right? He's going to love it. Be like, hey, we did a call-in game, and everyone wanted to talk about seeing your show from 50 years ago. Let's go to Patrick. Patrick, what do you got, Patrick?
Hey, Justin, how you doing, buddy?
I'm good. How about you?
I'm good. I just wanted to check in because you weren't sure about Old
yeah,
Chicago.
Yeah, right. You got Old Chicago info?
Yeah, well, yeah. It's an old amusement park from like the late 70s, early 80s,
okay,
and it was in Bolingbrook. It was an indoor amusement park.
Nice
and
job,
if
Pete.
I remember correctly, it had the world's first indoor loop roller coaster.
Really?
It was actually called the Chicago Loop. Anybody else that was around at that time can verify that for me. I think it was the world's first one. I might be wrong about that. I remember going to it when I was in the third grade. I'll be 50 this year, and I went when I was in the third grade. And one of the biggest things about Old Chicago that people complained about was that they had a mall-type area that you went through before you got to the actual amusement park, and they never utilized the storefronts properly and weren't really generating enough revenue. Also, my sister who used to go there said the sailors from Great Lakes used to always get into brawls. So that was another reason they shut it down. But,
wow.
Yeah, it was from back in the day. They still have the road to where it is. I live in Bolingbrook,
uh-huh.
And it's right off of 53 on Bolingbrook Drive. And there's a street called Old Chicago Drive. And if you go up that road, it's all, you know, warehouses now and a big car lot, like a car auction place now.
Awesome.
But, yeah.
Awesome,
back
Patrick.
In the day, but,
man, you made my day. You made my day, Patrick. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, you're very welcome. Glad to be of service.
All right, there you go. We should give Patrick something, man. Maybe he would want to go see Mary Poppins. He seems like the kind of guy I'd want to go see Mary Poppins, right? 312-981-7200, the phone number. We'll take a quick break, and we will get Rob Martier's news, and then we'll come back. We'll continue. Never Have I Ever on the download. 312-981-7200. Never Have I Ever. That's what we're playing tonight here on the download. 720 WGN 312-981-7200. Phone number. Gotten some good stuff and also some great history lessons. The Old Chicago was awesome. Just, Pete, you were able to pull that out. And you were pretty accurate. But we're getting more that are telling us more and more about. Someone said they went and saw a Halloween show at Old Chicago and Vincent Price was there. I know, right? I don't know how.
That's amazing.
It is. And I feel like I know a ton about Riverview. I feel like I know a lot about the history. But Old Chicago kind of gets passed up. I'm glad we got the WGN radio listeners to tell mm-hmm. us all about it. 708 says, I've never had soda pop in my whole life. What? That's healthy. You must be very healthy. I've never had tacos. I've never had Chinese food. I've never had a tomato. And I've never been on an airplane. This is like a riddle.
Wow.
It's like one of those riddles that, you know, like, you are a dog. Like, that's pretty crazy.
I've never eaten in Chinatown. Mm. Picked up, went through there, but I've never, like, went to a restaurant in Chinatown.
Yeah, I've been trying to think of that, because I was trying to think of, like, is there a food-based I never for me? I've been pretty good. I've been a very adventurous eater in my life. You know, like, I have some friends who, like, you know, my buddy Sandy from Schadenfreude always be like, oh, I'll just have a ham sandwich. No mayo, no mustard, just ham and bread. I'm like, what's the matter with you, man? But, like, I remember this one time we did a story with Steve Dolinsky. I was an editor for him, and we were doing a story about a new sushi craze, a place in Old Town. This is years ago. And they would kill the fish in front of you, and they would quickly gut it, and then they would take the piece of meat, and then they would, like, put it on a little sushi plate, and it would still be, like, kind of moving, and then you would eat it.
Ooh.
Yeah. That's adventurous eating.
Mm-hmm.
So whenever my son is like, I don't really want that, I'm like, let me tell you a story about
the sushi that was moving.
I ate a fish 5 seconds after it was killed. 815 says, I've never eaten a burger. What?
There's got to be...
Why? Is that because they're a vegetarian, maybe?
Yeah, I bet you now. Maybe they didn't get them when they were kids.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, they became vegetarian. Like a tomato. Like, I hated tomatoes when I was a kid. So then, eventually, you just, like, you...
Yeah. See. But tomatoes are in so many different foods.
Yeah.
You really have to go out of your way at some point to say, I don't like tomatoes, right?
Yeah.
It's one thing to say you don't like tomatoes, but to say you've never had a tomato means, yeah, you've never
like a
had
salad or
salad,
something.
Salad, a hamburger, a sandwich, tacos. I mean, tomatoes are in a lot of stuff.
I used to have tomato sandwiches. Speaking of ham sandwiches, Sandy, with the ham sandwich, I would have two pieces of white bread, some Miracle Whip, a little salt. Some tomatoes.
Wow.
Toast up the white bread if I wasn't in a rush.
All right. There you go. Was there cheese on it or no?
No cheese.
So it's just a toasted tomato sandwich.
Yeah. Pretty good.
It's very bachelor living. Yeah. Miracle Whip and tomato. Really.
A little salt.
You found that aisle in the grocery store.
I bet you feel like you made that, like a restaurant started serving tomato sandwiches would be like the next hot thing.
Like a $26 thing. Yeah. 312 says, I'm 47 years old, born and raised in Chicago, never been to the Sears Tower Sky Deck. Hmm. I feel like that's a good one.
Yeah.
I feel like even for me, I've been a couple of times, but it's kind of like, I feel like it's been generational. Like I was there when I was 14.
Right.
Was maybe when I was 25. I was there when I was, you know, brought my son there when I was 40. Or, you know, it's like, I feel like I've only been there three times in my life, but it's all like, like write a passage, like you had to do it.
I think, yeah, like we went as like on a field trip for school, like in, you know, eighth grade or something. I don't think I've been back since.
Yeah. Once you see it, you're kind of like, this is cool. All right. What's next?
We went to New York a few years ago and I wanted to go to the Empire State Building. And I got into the just like the lobby area and I like fear just came over me and I had to run out. I was like, I cannot go up there. Yeah.
Just like do you still have that?
I do have a little bit of a fear of heights. Yeah.
I think we all do, right? You get to a certain point, you get that feeling. You're like, it's too close to the edge.
But
It's probably, that sounds like it's a little too much. You know, just in the lobby. You didn't even go up the
elevator. Yeah, didn't even go up the elevator. Yeah.
All right, we got a lot of stuff here. Jan and Niles, she says she loves that tomato sandwich with Miracle Whip.
Am I right?
You open your own restaurant.
Yeah.
Man. That's good. 815, the one the burger says, no, I'm not vegetarian. I just don't like it.
Huh.
773 says, Mary Lou Henner was in the original Grease at Kingston Mines.
Really?
Yeah. We should get her in. You know, maybe I can. I'll tell the teacher. Hey, Mary Lou Henner's going to come too. We're really going to watch this. All right. I've never seen any money on the ground without picking it up. I've never seen money on the ground without picking it up.
Yeah.
All right. I've never, this is a good one. 847. Never have I ever seen a Star Wars movie. Love the old movies from the 40s.
Hmm.
And I'm not old. They made that.
Let's educate him. Today is May the 4th.
May the 4th be with you. Yeah.
That's a Star Wars reference.
Yeah. Well, I think, May the Force. Mm-hmm. Like it's Ben Kenobi. May the Force be with you, Luke. Yeah, that's all I got. 224 says, never have I ever put on water or snow skis. Okay.
Yeah.
Up until this winter, I had a never have I ever downhill skied. I think I might have done it when I was like in seventh or eighth grade or something and hated it and one thing. And I was like, I'm just going to hang out down here, which was very similar to what I did in Lake Geneva this winter. Like the same thing. I'm like, nah, I'm good here. I'm going to have this Sam Adams and hang out. I'm going to have this spotted cow. You guys do your thing. It's very similar. 630 says in response to the old Chicago, says it was the first and world's largest indoor amusement park. Sadly, poor financial mismanagement led to its closing. Sounds like they didn't do our friend said on the phone. They didn't do a good job with the mall stores. Mm-hmm. They could have made that a merry-go-round or a Forever 21. They could have got some more money out of it.
Doesn't the Mall of America in Minneapolis have an amusement park inside?
Never have I ever been to the Mall of America. So there you go. All right, I still got a ton more. There's at least 30 more here. I love it. And we have to pick one for the bike to drive. I have a favorite, but we'll find out coming here. 312-981-7200. We'll take a break, come back, and we will finish this up. So get your Never Have I Evers in now, and I'm giving away a pair of tickets for complimentary registration for two riders to MB Bike to Drive, which is coming up on May 28th. I'd say this is a successful game, Pete. You know, we always do it sort of occasionally here and there, but now that the Hawks are done for the year, you know, we've got more space in the show and it gives us a chance to try it out. I like it. I can't speak for the listeners. I think that they seem to like it, at least the ones that are participating. We get a ton of responses to the Never Have I Ever. 312-981-7200. All right, let me rapid fire through these. You ready, Pete?
Yeah, let's do it.
312, I've never been to Navy Pier since they turned it into an amusement park. They used to have concerts there when it was abandoned back in the 80s. That's a good one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're missing. I've always got the feeling from Navy Pier that you go once, you're like, all right, I saw it.
It's enough.
And they redid it. Now it's all sleek and silvery. So go there one more time and be like, all right.
New Ferris wheel, yeah. Try it out.
Yeah, try out the new, or look at it. You're good to go. All right, never 740. Never have I ever seen Gone with the Wind. Ooh, Jay from Ohio. Yeah, that's like me when I say I've never seen Citizen Kane.
Yeah, there's so many movies that are blind spots.
Yeah, 708. Oh, all right. Never have I ever married the right man.
Aw.
Oh, that's tough. That's a hard one, man. That, you know, I had an idea of what I wanted for the number one, but that might be it. Never have I ever married the right man. Oh, that's a...
Or how many chances?
That's, yeah, there's a lot of questions, a lot of follow-up questions to that text, right? 312-981-7200. I saw Billy Squire in concert when Chicago Fest was at Navy Pier, that's 630 says. There you go. I can't get over that one. 815 says, never have I ever eaten ketchup, but I love tomatoes. Then you might like it, right?
Yeah.
724 gets kitschy, and they say, I never have I ever listened to the radio. All right, we get it. You're listening to the radio right now. 847 says, never have I ever had coffee in any form other than sip. I had a sip one time. Also, never used hair conditioner. I'm 38.
Oh man,
I'm not a hair conditioner guy either, but I don't have any hair. But when I did, I wasn't a hair conditioner guy.
No one when I go on vacation, and I'm in a hotel, my hair is so conditioned, man. I am pumping that conditioner. Never any other time in the year. But I'm in a hotel, my hair is all conditioned.
If you bring that stuff back home, you'll never use it. You bring it home, you're like, oh, why did I bring this home? I don't condition at home. I only condition on the road. All right, keep going. Here we go. All right, let's see. I've got. We already did the Mary Lou Henner. all right. We did that. Okay, we've got to get through the. Okay, 312. I never have I ever seen any of the Godfather movies. I'm with you because it was just, when the HBO put that whole, they snipped together all of them to make one movie that was like 8 hours long.
Do you watch that?
That's the first time I've seen it. So I've never actually seen The Godfather in its real sort of iteration. I've only seen it sort of in that 8 hour weird form. So I think they took it out of place. So Godfather 2 was first and because of all that kind of
stuff.
Yeah. So I've never seen the actual straight ahead Godfather. Never have I ever seen the Lord of the Rings movies.
Mm-hmm.
You should see, those are good. I'm 64. Never have I tried smoking a cigarette. Larry. Greg Flam from the swap meet says there are Harambe-shaped Cheetos that sell for thousands of dollars. 708 says, never have I ever gotten to the end of the chapstick tube. Oh, we're getting there somewhere now. 815, never have I ever... until the last pickup truck, never have I ever owned an automatic transmission. 62 years old. 708 says, never have I ever liked Seth Rogen. That's so good. So good. All right, good. I think if I miss you tonight, there's a lot more, but we got to run. We can do it next. We'll do it next week. You know what? I got to give away. All right. So we're giving away complimentary registration for two riders at MB Bike to Drive on Sunday, May 28th. Kick off the summer and enjoy almost 5 hours of car-free riding on Lakeshore Drive. Proceeds benefit the nonprofit Active Transportation Alliance. Register at mbbiketodrive.org. We got a pair to give away. I want to give it away to 708, who said, never have I ever married the right man.
Yes.
That's so, come on. There's so much in there. There's heartbreak. It's telling. It's honest. It's emotional. Maybe it's funny. Maybe the husband's sitting right next to you.
Take a friend to the bike to drive. You might meet another disappointing.
there's a lot of disappointment on the bike to drive, I guess. Yeah. Thanks for playing, everybody. A lot of fun tonight. Let's do it again next week, shall we? We're playing Never Have I Ever here on The Download. All right, that's going to do it tonight. Patty Vasquez coming up next. Tomorrow night, we will do a little week in review. We'll find out. We'll reload this week's news with Aaron Freeman and Ken Davis, both here. We'll also talk about what's next. Now that we got past the healthcare vote, what's good? What big question about education. What can we expect from the Trump administration when it comes to education, curriculum, things like that? We'll be talking about that tomorrow night. On The Download, Patty Vasquez is here. Hi, Patty. How are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm good. What do you got on the show tonight?
We have our friend Deborah Vines, who is with it. She has a company called The Answer. She helps adults with special needs find whether it's education or care programs and, you know, sort of that what's next. Because at 21, our kids, when they age out of school, because individuals with disabilities can go to public schools until they're 21. And after that, it's kind of...
Interesting. So you don't know...
There's nothing after that. There's really no safety net for adults with disabilities really in place in the state of Illinois. So we're also going to talk a little bit about the House passing this part of Trump Care. What do you call it? Trump Care, Republic Care?
I call it Trump Care. We as Chicagoans have had to put up with him putting his name on the building. And he puts his name on everything. And then there's one thing he's like, no. You can put your name.
Yeah, but the building's nice. This sucks.
But I think, don't you think? I think RepublicCare, I think, works because it is something that they've crafted. They spent the last month, you know. So we'll talk about that with Attorney Chris Kennedy.
Chris Kennedy.
Yes. Yeah, good.
I would keep it Trump Care only because if it goes sour in any form, if the name Trump Care sticks, you'll see him blow a gasket. And that's the fun part of watching him blame other people. And it's not mine. I didn't do it. Don't put my name on it. He'll make it. It'll be a huge circus.
I think it's too much at stake. I think no matter what we call it, there's a lot at stake for people to make sure that they have the coverage they need. It's interesting the people talking about what's a win and what's a loss and things like that. And it seems like a lot of people lose. on this one.
Well, we'll see what happens here. I mean, it's still got a long way to go. I mean, it's kind of funny to think that everyone is acting as if it's done, and then I've heard some senators go, that's not even going to make it to our desk. Like, it's not even going to get to the floor.
That's the next part, is it has to go to the next chamber. I mean, this is... But what it does is it tells you where your representatives' morals are and where what they place value in. And so I think that people should look at the list of people who the representatives who voted for this and see where you play a part in their priorities.
And which representatives like crappy beer. Because there's a lot of crappy beer on at the White House today. They're all cracking cans of beer and acting like they were celebrating. They're like, finally, this is out of our hands until it's back in their hands.
But again, I think at this moment in history, people should pay attention to what they voted for.
There you
go. I think that it shows what they value.
Yeah.
It's so good to see you, Justin.
Yeah, good to see you. Have a good show.